You are good, Mr. Chair.
Okay. All right. It is 9:33 a.m. on January 5th. I call the meeting of the Committee on Behavior Analysts to order. This meeting is video hosted using Zoom. The public and parties on this agenda have been improperly noticed in this vacuum and supplied with the meeting access instructions. I'll be serving as chair for today's meeting as Ms. Denton is absent. Ms. Mouse, would you take role, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Dr. Stenhoff,
Here.
Dr. Davey,
Present.
Dr. Raitt,
Present.
and Dr. Byra is absent, and Ms. Benson are absent. We have a quorum.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Mouse. Agenda item number three. I just wanted to thank the board staff. Thanks. You guys do a lot of great work protecting, but also just trying to get all the documentation together and having it prepared for us to review and your responsiveness to our questions. I appreciate it a lot. And Ms. Galvin as well, your legal advice is so much needed, and we appreciate the work that you do for us as well. So thank you for that too. So moving on to the next part of that, the Board of Psychological Examiners is approved by the BACB as an ACE continuing education provider. Attending the meeting of the Board's Committee on Behavior Analysts is eligible for continuing education credit for maintenance of BACB certification and for Arizona licensure renewal. To claim this credit, make note of the code words provided hourly throughout the meeting. To report the words to the board staff for purposes of earning continuing education credit, look for the link on the board's meeting page for this particular meeting. And Ms. Mouse, will you be providing those as well?
Yes, I will.
All right, great. Thank you. All right, let's move on to agenda item number four, approval of minutes, December 1st regular session minutes and December 1st executive session minutes, both of 2023. Can we approve both of those in one motion? Okay, do I have a motion to approve those minutes then?
I'll make a motion.
Okay, thank you. In a second.
I'll second.
Okay, further discussion? All right, motion carries. All right, agenda item number five, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding proposed legislation, including but not limited to HB 2068. Ms. Pakenham, would you like to take the lead on that and maybe introduce the other people listed on this agenda item?
Yes, Mr. Chair, super briefly, because we want to save as much of this time that we can to hear from Ms. Patrone, who represents AZ ABA. She has a needs to be at a 10 o'clock, so let's make sure that she has adequate time to provide any updates relative to the bill, House Bill 2068, of which you have a copy. And then I'm sure the committee members will have questions for her. So I will hand it off to Ms. Patron.
Thank you, Heidi. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, everybody. Again, Brandy Patron with Gibbon Schwartz Public Affairs representing AZ ABA today. We just wanted to provide the committee with an update on where we are with the legislation that we're proposing to separate out the regulation of behavior analysts and create their own board. At our last conversation, we had talked to you all about the fact that we needed to submit a Sunrise application. That Sunrise application was submitted to the legislature in proper time. We had talked about the fact that potentially there may be a hearing related to that. We are still not anticipating that the legislature will ask for a specific hearing related to the Sunrise. Because as I call this, it's a non-Sunrise Sunrise, because as you know, we're not requesting any scope of practice changes. We're literally in our minds just making the committee its own board. So we don't anticipate a separate hearing needing to happen for that. But should that change, well, we will obviously let the committee and the board know that that's taking place. In addition to that, we did, the bill has been introduced, as Ms. Pakenham said. So it's House Bill 2068. Representative Bliss is the sponsor of the legislation. The bill itself and the language is almost identical to what you all saw in draft form. There were some additional technical changes that Legislative Council made, which is the drafting arm of the legislature, conforming technical changes. So the bill itself is longer than the draft that you all saw, but that's because the technical and conforming changes have now been added. But the substantive changes are the same. This committee had recommended a couple of other changes, or asked staff to look at, I should say, had asked staff to take a look at some other changes to conform the statutes to what currently exists under the psychology board. We did take a look at those recommendations and did make most of the changes that were recommended by staff and a couple of, I think, board members that had looked at it offline. One of the changes we did not make that I just wanted to make everyone aware of, there was a recommendation to take out the 1,500-hour requirement. Because what we are trying to do is to create the self-regulation and simply create the board in place of the committee, we felt like that was too substantive of a change in policy to do at this time. So we did not make that change in the legislation. That's something I think that AZABA will probably likely want to take up at a future time. But for political reasons, quite frankly, we did not think it was appropriate to do it this time in this bill. So I did want to let the committee know that as well. The legislative session starts next week on Monday. The bill will be officially introduced sometime next week and then available for a hearing. The House Health Committee is the committee we believe it will likely be assigned to, and that committee meets on Mondays. So we're anticipating a hearing, you know, in the next 2 to 3, 4 Mondays, and we will obviously keep Ms. Packinen updated on that hearing and this committee and the board as we move forward in the process. I think with that, Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to answer any questions of the committee, and thanks for allowing us some time today.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Patron. Committee members, does anybody have any questions for Ms. Patron?
No.
Okay. Ms. Packenham.
Mr. Chair, if you'll indulge me, I have just a couple of comments. What Ms. Patron explained with respect to the political realities that we need to acknowledge specific to, you know, considering the change to the 1,500-hour requirement, I do understand that for what that is worth. And so, you know, I respect that this is not going to be proposed in this bill. I do think that when AZABA has the interest, I think in the interim, so this summer, you know, we should probably have a conversation about that on a future meeting agenda together, AZABA and the committee, and discuss that. We understand, I understand that it only takes, you know, just sort of one, what seems like a very small, minor change in the scheme of things in a bill to torpedo the entire thing. And so that is the last, you know, outcome we might, we would want to see, right? So for what that's worth, I offer, you know, my perspective. And I did, by way of reassurance, I saw all of the new changes, the conforming changes that Ms. Patron alluded to. It all seemed appropriate, routine, you know, nothing in there was of any concern to me. I wouldn't expect necessarily the committee or the board for that matter to sort of, you know, understand the necessity for all of those changes, but I certainly do. So that's sort of my commentary and perspective on the bill that will be debated. And as Ms. Patron said, we could hear this in committee very soon, and I'm prepared for that to happen even as early as Monday the 15th. So I assure you I will be at the hearing as a resource.
Thank you, Ms. Packenham. Any other questions or comments from committee members or even board staff?
Chair.
Dr. Davey.
Thank you. Just wondering kind of like the cadence of updates we should expect, Brandy, knowing that the legislative process has a lot of twists and turns, and understanding that how committees may decide to hear or not hear, when they'll actually have that discussion. Is there a way that you can kind of keep board staff in kind of in real time, updated versus kind of at these monthly CBA meetings? Just so if we do need members of the board to be present at a hearing, along with kind of the stakeholders that were available, or if there's things that we can do even as private citizens to be able to help. But I just think it would be helpful if you were in constant communication with Ms. Pakkinen as we go forward.
Absolutely, Dr. Davey, Mr. Chairman. That is definitely our intention. As we've talked about before with AZIABA and the board and committee, we see this as a partnership in moving forward on this legislation and working with you all. So we will absolutely keep staff apprised as we understand what's happening, timing, et cetera. Things change. And obviously we'll let Ms. Pakkinen give you all those updates as she sees fit. I also know that she keeps very well track of the legislative process as well, because there's always surprises that happen in general that may impact the board and the committee, not just this bill. So I know she's on top of it too, but that is absolutely our intention, is to keep you all apprised of what we're understanding is happening in the process and sort of any twists and turns that take place.
Thank you so much.
Got it.
Any other questions or comments? Okay. Well, thank you. Ms. Patron, thank you for being here to share that with us. And we look forward to hearing the updates as they come. And as you said, I'm sure Ms. Pakkinen as well will be keeping us well informed as she usually does. So thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you for the time.
All right. Moving on to agenda item number six, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding complaint number 24-09 against Paige Huff and recommendation of the board. I'm going to start off reading a statement. Note that a person or representative of a person who is filed or is subject to a complaint and is present today may make a brief statement up to 5 minutes to the committee when prompted by me. The committee may also have questions for the complainant or respondent after their statement. Only individuals directly involved with the complaint, which are the complainant and respondent, may address the committee and make a statement. If the committee wishes to hear from another party, we'll make this request during the case review. For everyone in attendance today, please ensure your audio remains on mute. When prompted by the committee to speak, the complainant, respondent, and their legal representatives may unmute themselves at this time. Please note that individuals in attendance who speak out without committee approval will be warned twice by the chair not to interrupt. If the interruption continues after a second warning, the individual will be removed from the Zoom meeting and not permitted to re-enter the meeting. Please only use initials for patients or children and the complainant. Be aware that content of the records involved in these complaints is confidential and the content should not be discussed in a public meeting. The committee may go to executive session to discuss any confidential records or to receive confidential legal advice from the board's attorney, Jean Galvin. For those in attendance, please be aware that the chair reserves the right to change the order of the items on the agenda based on the parties present and request to speak. Committee members, this is a case review, and so just keep that in mind as we go discuss this. So I am the lead on this, and I will give a summary of this, and we'll hear further from as the board has made this recommendation. There is not a complaint present for this today, and so we will definitely hear from Ms. Huff, and I believe Ms. Pakkinen, Ms. Huff has legal representation here present as well.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I did see her counsel as a attendee.
Okay, thank you. All right, so it's public meeting, September 1st, 2023. The board accepted a recommendation from the committee on behavior analysts to open a complaint against Ms. Huff for further investigation relating to information reviewed, received concerning the involvement related to two complaint numbers 23-02 and 20-051 against Mr. Huff for ex-husband. The record indicates this complaint was filed by the Blue Cross Blue Shield of Arizona alleging inappropriate billing, inadequate record keeping, multiple relationships relative to Adventure ABA staff who provide services to their three children. and the appropriateness of the service provided for multiple clients. As the owners, Ms. Hove employed Ms. Nicole Holmes, an LBA, who also provided behavior analytic services to her three children. On July 26, 2023, the committee also reviewed a complaint, number 2051, against Mr. Hove regarding the allegation that he failed to report information to the board relating to possible unprofessional conduct on the part of Ms. Hove, potential due relationship. The information reviewed by the committee indicates that Ms. Hove had or previously had engaged in a romantic relationship with an employee of Adventure ABA. The committee discussed that she had alleged conduct may constitute a dual or multiple relationship in possible violation of sections 1.11, multiple relationships, of the BACB Ethical Code for Behavior Analysts. Ms. Hove responded that she and Mr. Hove attempted to manage the potential multiple relationships by removing themselves from the child's treatment. There's no allegation of harm to the children, and that Ms. Hove was not responsible for providing professional services to her children or the clinical supervision of the Adventure ABA employees or contractors. It was indicated that the board cannot discipline Ms. Hove license because of a grievance may have with her business owner. It's unconnected by unprofessional practice or the limited private activity of the board. Ms. Hove is currently working with a practice monitor. And has reported this complaint to the monitor as of December 27th of 2023. Let's see. So another concern that was brought up was section 1.14 of the ethics code of the BACB relating to romantic sexual relationships with current client stakeholders, trainees, or supervisees. It was noted that the person that was with the multiple relationship or the alleged multiple relationship is not a client stakeholder, trainee, or supervisee. And so there's a request that this complaint be dismissed. So this ends my review. Ms. Huff, I'll open it up to you and counsel if you guys want to make a 5-minute statement.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Michael Rain. Can you hear me okay?
Right. Yes, I can. Yeah, thank you.
Counsel for Ms. Huff, and I'll try and be brief. We did provide our written response and really have not much new to report, but I just want to quickly summarize what we've told you there. Which, you know, really has two parts. There's some complex legal arguments that are made that I'll bore you a little further with in a moment. But first and foremost, I think that the main theme of the response was to address the board's concern or the committee and the board's concerns about, the possible multiple relationships with Ms. Huff having her children receive services from a company she owned. A couple of key points that we think mitigate that substantially are that, first of all, before this complaint was filed, the care had stopped. Her children were no longer receiving treatment. And as you discussed in your summary, Ms. Huff was actually not licensed until quite near the very end of this activity. She did own the facility, but she did not get her license nearly till the end. She did not provide any clinical services related to the care of her children. She didn't have any supervisory role over Ms. Holmes. Ms. Holmes was an independent contractor. And there's some allegations in there of, I guess, for lack of a better word, interference that Ms. Holmes felt. You know, primarily, I would say that her comments in the complaint that were reported by Blue Cross Blue Shield complaint were more largely directed at her ex-husband. But, you know, she does dispute some of the statements in there, such as, you know, not participating in parenting sessions as you might expect of a parent or other small facts that she would dispute if we got that far. But we just want you to understand that Ms. Huff understands the board's concerns. There is no dispute that having this situation where her children were being treated by someone who might have felt, for lack of a better word, beholden, or might show greater deference to a parent or defer more to a parent because that parent happened to be someone that had some connection to Ms. Holmes' pay. We get that. And Ms. Holmes clearly felt that. You see that in her complaint. And so just to be clear, although we'll make some legal arguments here in a second, there's not a dispute that it's a legitimate concern to have. And we just want the board to, or the committee to understand it was over before this complaint was. There's no other instances of this that we're aware of ever occurring at Venture EDA. And we provided a policy and procedure that the company implemented that prohibits family, friends, anyone related to the clinical staff there at Venture EDA from getting into this similar situation in the future. So there's really no concern, or there, we hope there is no concern at the committee that this is an ongoing problem, something you need to make sure doesn't happen again. We think that's all well taken care of at this point. It was actually taken care of before the complaint came in, but with the policy and the procedure in place, we hope that you see there's no need for an ongoing oversight of this particular issue. In addition, we described it a little bit. Ms. Huff may be available to describe this to you, too. One other big mitigating factor is Ms. Huff, as a parent, as a mom, really felt that she had no other access to care for her children. She may be able to describe that in a little more detail, but she had been discharged from a handful of providers and really just was struggling to find the care her kids needed and thought well of Ms. Holmes and, you know, reports that she was satisfied, you know, generally with the treatment. She's, you know, in terms of patient harm, she doesn't, and stakeholder concerns as a parent and a stakeholder, you know, there were no concerns for her that this relationship caused a problem as the recipient or the parent of the recipient. But really it was driven by necessity in her mind to get the care she thought her children needed. But, especially in light of all of these events, you know, she had stopped this environment from continuing, and it won't continue again. Briefly on the legal issues, there's something quite unique about this case, which is that the board has the ethical standards, and the way you enforce the ethical standards is you either articulate them in your rules verbatim, or you're allowed to incorporate outside material by reference. But there's a law in Arizona in Title 41 that says exactly how you have to do that. You have to say exactly which version of those ethical codes you are adopting, and you have to literally say, and no subsequent amendments are included. You have to adopt a new rule for every amendment. So there's a couple points there. Number one is, at the time these events occurred, the current version of the ethical code wasn't in place. That didn't come until the very, yeah, I think it was 2022, right at the very, very tail end of the treatment of the children. So we're looking more at the 2019 version of the code, which has some meaningful differences when you look at multiple relationships. And it just does not fit this environment where Ms. Huff wasn't providing any clinical services or supervision of clinical services. So even with the 2019 code in place, we don't think that there's an ethical code violation technically. I would implore you to look deeper into this as your committee moves forward, and especially with bills in place or any rulemaking in place. It is my personal legal opinion that you cannot enforce your ethical code because of the invalidity of the rule adopted. And therefore, we would suggest you look into that. You might want to do some rulemaking to avoid people like me coming in and making these arguments, because everyone agrees you need an ethical code. And to be clear, we're not saying that Ms. Huff or any other licensee shouldn't continue to comply with the current ethical code. But ultimately, if you want to impose any sort of remedy in a case, you need a legal basis to do it. And we just want you to know that we do believe that there's a lack of that here. But again, that's not really the point. The point is, this is stuff that happened from 2020 to 2022. It had ended before the complaint came in. It will not resume. Put structure in place to make sure no other employees or have their family or friends treated at the facility. And with that, we'd say Ms. Huff is on her probation with her monitor. There was some confusion with board staff, and that's my fault. we had suggested that, hey, one way to deal with this that makes sense is to just make sure the monitor is aware of it and can make sure this isn't happening. Have discussion with Ms. Huff or anyone she needs to confirm those facts and help put better structure in place. What have you? It just seemed like a good tool to use. Steph expressed a concern because when they reached out to the monitor said, I'm not aware of this. And we spoke about that offline. And I said, I'm sorry. What I meant to suggest is that's a proposal. But having heard that concern, then Ms. Huff informed her monitor about it. They've discussed it. She continues to be more than happy to make sure this is part of that review. It already kind of is now because she's informed of it. But we felt that, one way to deal with this rather than a new punishment or any sort of order would be to just make sure that everyone's aware of this, that it will be addressed. It will be ensured that what she's done to make sure it doesn't happen again stays in place and is sufficient to address this concern. Last thought, and I'm probably already out of time, but I will just say, as it pertains to the relationship with Ms. Huff's current husband, now the individual mentioned in the complaint, the second part of the complaint, there seemed to just be a lack of knowledge. What is this person's role at Adventure ABA? And we let you know this, there's zero clinical role whatsoever, not as a clinician, as a supervisor. It is a purely administrative employee with no clinical licensure or activity whatsoever. And we don't think that the board has the power to tell anyone who they get to marry and work with in that environment without any clinical connection. But definitely, again, another concern to be aware of. It's another thing the monitor could be sure of. Let's be sure that that person doesn't begin a clinical component to their work or something. But in terms of just, is that a multiple relationship? We would argue, no, it isn't because of the lack of any clinical component. Just like, Ms. Huff and her ex-husband, Mr. Huff, were married, and there needs to be some room for people to live their life in America as married people owning businesses and performing their profession. And in their case, maybe some structure should have been in place back when they were married and owning the business. But here, to the extent we need some structure to make sure this is, adhere to, that there is no future clinical role, then that's fine, but we just don't see a violation. So with that, I'll leave it for questions for Ms. Huff, because we're probably well over time, and I'll stop there and open it back up to the board.
Thank you, Mr. Rainey. Ms. Huff, do you have any further comments?
No, I mean, I know one of the questions that has been is why we couldn't receive services at other places. We went through a lot. We were discharged from one. We were cut hours when my daughter was still engaging in severe self-injurious behaviors. And Mr. Huff or I did not plan on having three kids with autism, but it definitely, created a lot of things. We went to another place and they were billed for individual therapy when they were receiving group therapy, which cost us thousands and thousands of dollars in bills. And there was a lot of issues that took place in the field. And I know the field is changing every day. We are becoming more ethical and more, open to things, but I have them on wait lists forever. And when your daughter does not talk, and she needs an AAC device and she needs services, and so does your son and your other kid, you need to work on it early. As we know, early intervention is important. And so it just felt very strange, calling a bunch of companies, trying to get them in and no one being able to service us. Not only were we an owner of a company, but we were up north at the 303 and the 101, and there are no services here.
All right. Thank you. All right. Okay. So, fellow committee members, do any of you have questions for Ms. Huff or counsel?
Clap? No. Raise hand. There we go. I'm going to clap and raise my hand at the same time. I can't hit the red button politely.
Dr. Davey, yes, I acknowledge you. Your hand clapping and hand raising.
That was to get your attention and then the hand raise.
Thank you.
I've had to like stop with the hand motions when I talk because apparently like fireworks go off on the background and all kinds of things are like happening apparently thanks to Zoom. And so please be aware. I think I appreciate the comments from staff. You know, I think Ms. Huff, I think my question is directed more to you, right? I mean, we've now spent some significant time together as committee members with you over the course of multiple years, multiple meetings, and have addressed a myriad of concerns over that period of time. And I agree this one is a little bit back in the past that has come to light through other discoveries. And I think my question is you know, is to you of like, how does this fit into your current program, your current practice monitoring that you're going through with your BCBA in terms of some of the things that we talked about in your last agreement with us, right? There was very clear areas that we believed you needed to have some professional coaching on, that you needed some more experience on, feedback on. And so I'd like to hear from you directly how these things are tying together for you.
Paige, I'll just jump in. You go ahead and answer that question.
Okay. This is probably going to be long-winded because I just starting off, you know, I was an RBT, I was a BCABA, I got my BCBA under somebody who was not licensed in Arizona, and then I continued on. We all know there's been a lot of supervision that has taken place, but when I did an interview with my practice monitor, I think one of the things that hit me so hard that I like finally expressed was like, my supervision has never been adequate. I have always been, you know, just told to do some things, or my supervisor was gone, or I had to fight for a supervisor at one company. And I am realizing just how much the supervision, like lack of that I had, like strict rules and stuff set forth has caused a lot of things. And so I turned into my next practice monitor, right? And we're going through, and my current practice monitor and I are going through different assessments, and I'm learning that like, we got, you know, 60% there with all my documentation, but that's not mastery, right? We are looking at 80%, 90%, or 100% within things. And so as I continue with this, the outline that my practice monitor has brought forth is very open. It's very strict. It has the guidelines I need and continues to put me forth. I also am now the business owner. I don't have somebody else who is causing issues with anything. So I'm able to make all of the changes that I need to do and put forth. And I think that is a huge difference. This is my revamp, right? I am working really hard to ensure that these things don't continue moving forward. And with that, it means paying attention, taking things slow. My practice monitor is always like, don't freak out now. Let's just do this one step at a time. And I think that is where I'm at. Instead of trying to push all of these policies and procedures on, we're making that effective, lasting change to have everybody at the company continue with this documentation, with different policies, continue to go through all the ethics, and doing it in a systematic and orderly way that is going to maintain and keep going through months. I've only been in with my practice monitor for this would be my third month, but I already see a huge lasting change. I see my BCBAs going to more CEUs. I see me going to more CEUs, trying to learn more and putting our best foot forward. And that is really what I want to do, is encompass all of that. And not only the things that were concerning from the board, but looking at all of the scope of practices, all of everything, and modifying it to follow a more rigid, documented, ethical way.
Thank you. And I see that your practice monitor is present today too. So that speaks highly. And your understanding of your progress so far, like I would say that, you know, two things stuck out to me in your response. And one of them, you know, with regard to mastery criteria around particular areas, right? I would just implore you to consider, and I'm sure your practice monitors had this conversation with you, is that there are certain behaviors as a professional, as a licensed behavior analyst in the state of Arizona and a nationally certified behavior analyst through the BACB, that have to be at 100%. You know, your professional conduct cannot be at 80% and surely cannot be at 60%, correct? And so there are those areas that have to be above reproach every single day. And, you know, doing it 8 out of 10 times is not going to be appropriate and will lead to further discussions. And so I want to make sure that we're on the same page with regard to that. And while I appreciate council's discussion around which ethical codes are, you know, in play, when and where and how, you know, my bigger question is today, the ethical codes that are in place that bind Ms. Huff, you know, as a nationally certified behavior analyst or right here in the state of Arizona, do have very clear statements with regard to behavior around multiple relationships and around a coercive behavior between those that you may be in a position of power for. And so I understand the timing and I understand your discussion, council, and appreciate it. But I think for my understanding going forward, I would like to hear, you know, what guardrails Ms. Huff has up in place now to maintain being above reproach in those areas of multiple relationships, besides signing the document.
Committee Member Davey, I would say we did provide the policy and procedure, but that's just a document, you know.
Agreed.
So of course, all the policies and procedures that she is implementing from her other cases, of course, they're only as good as their enforcement and the adherence. And so, you know, I'm not aware of, and Paige, when I'm done, just jump in, but I'm not aware of there being any other similar instance of any person having friends or family treated at Adventure ADA in any sense. This was a one-time issue. So there really isn't anything to necessarily have corrected from the past. I'm not sure, Paige, you can describe any communication you had about this policy with staff. But with the practice monitor aware of this particular issue and the policy, you know, it's, I think it just goes hand in hand with all the effort. You got to have the policies, but you also have to implement them. And yeah. They're a living thing.
And I think that's my point, counsel, is like, I appreciate the policy. I'd like to hear Ms. Huff talk through what the reality of that is. And I think it's not only the policy around multiple relationships around services provided to perhaps employees or people that certain employees are connected to, but also multiple relationships in terms of personal relationships that may occur in the workforce, which is more of an HR situation versus the latter. So I would just, you know, with your permission, I'd like Ms. Huff to just kind of have that conversation with us.
Please go ahead, Ms. Huff.
Okay. Just to clarify, when I said 60, 80, 90%, I was talking more in the shaping of what we're doing, you know, getting up to that standard so we can continue forward with that. But when it comes to multiple relationships, it's actually come up a lot. There, you know, we have a referral program. So a lot of people are like, let me hire my spouse on, let me do this. And then as well as, you know, clients, parents who are like, I want to come work for you. I want to be a behavior therapist. It just happened last week. And so a lot of it is knowledge within the company. So, you know, people being able to refer those parents to other ABA companies, like you can't be a behavior therapist with us, but you can go to these companies instead. As far as relationships go, we don't hire anybody who's in a relationship with each other or anything like that. If there's something that's developed, we have forms. We actually did not have HR back when when we had less employees and stuff, we had somebody slightly managing it, but now we have a full, part of our company, which has been for a couple of years now, who manages those types of dual relationships. They understand them. They have the documentation, the forms, and it's all sorted out from there, where if they're in a relationship, maybe they go to a separate clinic or, you know, one leaves and the other one stays based off of what is happening if they develop that relationship in the workplace, as well as documentation with how, you know, creating like dual relationships or having that, you know, people can be friends outside of the workplace, but also like finding the ways to handle and manage those situations as part of our assessment of every situation that's going on. Outside of that, we really do refer them to other places because the ABA world needs a lot of RBTs, and I'm sure a lot of parents are passionate, but coming to our company and working is not ethical.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Huff, I've got a question. You indicated that there might be movement to, if a relationship is formed during the course of employment, that the individual might move to a different location or might leave the company. In the situation that that came to light, where the relationship was formed between you and a, I would argue, a subordinate, what would that look like? Could you explain how that, if that were to arise with an employee in your company, how would that be dealt with more explicitly than just that they would leave or whatever, you know, or move to another branch? You know, there's certain individuals that are handled extremely sensitive information or deal with billing and so on, which could cause some, you know, get into the realm of the optics of what the billing might look like or fraudulent billing and so on. I'm not making that accusation, whatever. I'm just using it as an example. But what would that look like if that were to occur?
And please, before you answer, I just want to add to that question, which is if you do have any specific examples, then you could share those as well, in addition to, you know, in theory.
Okay. So with that, that's more like if an RBT starts dating an RBT, typically we've never had a situation where a BCBA dates like an RBT or anything like that, or they form a relationship. So with what we have dealt with, it is that the RBTs separate themselves. They're not on the same cases. They don't have the same supervisor. And as far as with anybody in like administrative, they have different managers. I'm sorry, I feel like I'm losing the question here. So our policies would be to separate whoever is with each other. If it is like a supervisor and an administrative role, they don't work together. They don't have any ongoing supervision of that person. With my partner, it was just payroll. So that is, they just complete the hours, get payroll going, and complete that. And then as far as the other relationships that we have dealt with, it's been more of an RBT and an RBT coming together, reporting to their supervisor, the BCBA, us documenting with HR, creating the dual relationship forms, separating that out, ensuring that they're not on the same cases, ensuring that they're at different locations, and ensuring that the supervisors are different.
So in that regard, the example you brought up of your partner and yourself, that partner at the time was a subordinate. How would that be dealt with now with new policy?
With the new policy, well, I have a business partner now, and so we manage different aspects of the company and it's split. So if that were to happen, it would be under the other business partner.
Okay. And then in regard to any other level. So if the subordinate was a direct report, and you know, I know you have a business partner now, but you still, let's just say that you're at 50% as the owner, how might you deal with that under the people that are under your report tos that you're working with? How would that be managed? So give me okay, let me back up. What do you, give me one area you directly oversee?
RBT supervision.
Okay. So if an RBT, this hypothetical, fell under your, or BCBA that was supervising an RBT, so under them, how would you deal with a possible relationship with a BCBA who's under your direct supervision?
Okay. Is this okay? So what would happen is they are, so in our handbook, everything, so the policies that we have up forth and that people are trained on, or, you know, the ethical boundaries as well as dual relationships, coming forth with any dual relationships, being objective, understanding that you may have a dual relationship forming. So the first report is to go to me or HR, depending on who they would like to go to. I typically get involved if needed, or HR can manage these situations as well with my other business partner, but they would let the HR know. We would look at the dual relationships, determine any cases, determine if there was anything that happened that caused any issues with cases during the dual relationship forming, document everything, put it all into a file, make sure the dual relationship forms are signed and separate those cases and those people moving forward, as well as ensuring that anything that has happened with the dual relationship is addressed.
So I guess I want some assurance, though, that if there's a, in your company, if there's a subordinate, and let's just maybe just go directly to you, if there's a subordinate that there's a relationship with and they report to you, what would take place at that point? You've indicated filling out paperwork, but we're also working in an industry where we are billing insurance companies or billing families directly. And there's that line that exists there as the owner of the company to a subordinate, whatever their role is. But in those sensitive areas where money's involved, where supervision is involved, what would take place right now, hypothetically, if a relationship developed between yourself and a report to, would they be terminated from the company? Would they be moved to underneath somebody else? Because the responsibilities of the company are clearly delineated under you and clearly delineated under your business partner, and in each of you having your respective roles, how would that be managed at this time if that were to occur?
Yeah, so we have, depending on the severity of the relationship, either separated them under, because my business partner
I'm sorry, can I interrupt you? What do you mean by severity of a relationship?
So, I mean, I'm talking more like, you know, somebody comes to me and they're like, we are friends outside, like we want to hang out.
Okay, but I'm saying, okay, so you're saying an intimate relationship or further.
Okay.
To use an old term, boyfriends and girlfriends. Let's just go there. All right, okay. Just make it easy. So, if that were to transpire, what would be the response of you as the business owner?
Okay, so it would be more so that the person would either fall under a different aspect, a different BCBA, and it would be separated, or they would, if it was under me, they'd be moved from the company.
Okay. All right. That was my question. Okay. Thank you. All right. Any further questions? Dr. Reitz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have one question, and I'd like to better understand where your company stands and what your policies are around RBTs, BCBAs traveling with a family for a vacation, for a trip, for an extended period of time. What policies are in place?
Paige, you can go ahead and address that. That's committee member rights. That's not something we were asked to address in our response. So candidly, we just let you know we're moving on the fly.
Sure. And this is really, again, related to multiple relationships.
I understand. I just, Paige, go ahead.
So right now, our policy is that it does not occur anymore. We have had it in the past where we had outlines of it. It just became too many issues and it was shut down.
Thank you.
Any other questions from committee members? I would like to make a motion that we move to executive session for legal advice. Do I have a second?
A second.
All in favor say aye.
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 Okay, motion carries. Now at about an hour in, Ms. Malice, do you have a code word for us?
Yes, I do, Dr. Stenhoff. The code word is golden. It's golden, G-O-L-D-E-N. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Okay. Does anybody have any further questions for Ms. Huff or counsel before we jump into deliberation? All right, so with that, we are going to move into deliberation. This is a time for the committee members to discuss this without any interruption. So I'll go ahead and lead off, as I was the reviewer for this. When we look at the consent agreement, there's obviously a lot of carryover or similarities between what it transpired prior and to what we're currently hearing today. And with that, the issue lies with that it did in fact occur, and some of the issues regarding propriety during the supervision of hired staff and so on, give me some concern. And well, counsel and Ms. Huff also pointed out that it was towards that she'd only been a BCBA more recently, at the end of that period of time. Nevertheless, she was still performing her work as a BCBA. And so I guess I have some concern with that, I'd like to hear from other committee members on what you all think, and continue a discussion.
Director Stenhoff, I'd agree. I think while it may be a short period of time, it still was a time when she was licensed as a behavior analyst in the state. I think what we've discussed today is correct, similar to what we've discussed in the past in terms of documentation, in terms of supervision, in terms of multiple relationships. It feels, while different instances, it feels very much similar to the things that we've discussed previously. So.
Dr. Davey, any further comments?
Yeah, I think I would just, I think it does, it is similar to the discussions that led to a consent agreement previously and that led to the practice monitor that is in place, that we had discussed that there was documentation shortcomings for Ms. Huff and for the agency, that there's a need to be able to produce documents, to be able to produce and modify policies and procedures and the forms necessary to be effective and compliant in terms of their operation as an agency. I think with regard to the current complaint, while I feel it fits that framework, I also believe that this is a separate complaint and requires us to respond to it. And I think in terms of thinking through what we've got, the current consent agreement is definitely the framework for us to be able to tackle this. However, in closing the loop around this, most likely using our ability to issue a decree of censure around this particular matter, just highlighting the issues with regard to policy procedure deficiencies, supervisory roles not being clearly delineated again, records at that particular point in time, or records and documentation at that particular point in time not being available, lack of general HR understanding, documentation related to supervision, not only for on the clinical side, but also on the administrative side of the organization. And I think that would allow us to kind of close out this matter and then allow Ms. Huff to continue to work through a current consent agreement and concurrently address these issues.
Dr. Davey, I mean, would you be comfortable having that be a motion at this time? Or?
Yeah, I'm happy to make it a little bit cleaner motion. I mean, I think in terms of the motion would be to issue a decree of censure with regard to this matter. I think that the issue at hand falls under ARS 3229-2091-12H, which is failing or refusing to maintain and retain adequate business records, financial or professional records, and particularly the professional records pertaining to the behavior analytics services. And so I think that that would be my the piece around the decree censure with regard to this. I also think that with regard to behavior analytic code, notwithstanding counsel's objection to the use of it, I still believe that we have issues that could be cited as fact finding of under ARS 2091-12BD, which fall right in line again with the current consent agreement, and that's around boundaries of integrity. Conforming to legal and ethical codes for society and professional community of which they are members. I think that that would be C 1.04D.
Right. And boards, let's see. Do we have a second for that motion?
I will second.
Okay. Then any further discussion?
My discussion would be for board staff to chime in about, or even Ms. Galvin, that do we need to include in this motion that we believe that the current framework of the consent agreement addresses this concurrently with this decree?
There has been discussion among the committee members recognizing that she is under a consent agreement where there is monitoring, where issues similar to what you have found today are being addressed. And that could be part of the decree of censure where you recognize that previous findings of the board are being addressed and you recognize that that monitoring and reporting will continue as part of the other cases. So there would be a recognition in this decree of censure that there is monitoring, current and ongoing monitoring of Ms. Huff.
And then my only other discussion to committee members would be just the comfort with the compliance code for behavior analysts that I identified, which was the integrity one. I selected that one because I believe it encompassed multiple areas, but I would be open to any further discussion around others that would fit the current, that previous pattern of behavior.
Dr. Davey, I would concur with that. And I don't see the need to add any further to that because I think both those do, as you stated, encompass the issues. That Dr. Reitz, any further?
No, I agree.
Okay. All right, so the motion's been made, it's been seconded. Any further discussion?
Just a clarification, if I may. This is a recommendation to the board that it would go to the board for further review or investigation, but a recommendation from the committee that a decree of censure be offered based upon the facts discussed and the violations that have been cited. A roll call. It's a proposed agreement for discipline.
Okay. Ms. Malice, would you, I'm going to back up. Any further discussion? Okay. Ms. Malice, would you do the roll call vote, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Dr. Davey?
Yes.
Dr. Reitz?
Yes.
Dr. Stenhoff?
Yes.
The motion passes.
Okay. All right. Okay, thank you. Thank you, Council and Ms. Huff, for being here. Board staff will be in contact with you to provide further information about the next stages of what will happen.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Thank you. Okay, let's see. Agenda item number 7, discussion, consideration, and possible action. Board pertaining to approval, behavior analyst application, applicants. I am going to, Dr. Rates, yes, sorry.
Mr. Chair, I'm just wondering if we can take a quick comfort break.
Yeah.
You bet. Yeah, so we'll take a comfort break and reconvene at 11 o'clock. Again, we're moving into the next agenda item, the consideration of approval of applications for behavior analysts. I am going to probably move around a little bit due to the attendees that are here. So just be aware of that, committee members. So the first applicant will be Megan Clark. Dr. Davey, you're the lead. Oh, Dr. Davey, you're muted.
Thank you, Dr. Sonhoff.
And Ms. Clark is on the call as well.
I see her. I see the thumbs up. All right, Ms. Clark, thank you very much for submitting your application. Application was completed in its entirety. Individual comes forward seeking licensure in the state of Arizona, had provided us information with regard to her work in Texas, as well as in Missouri. When going through her supervisory activities, I took a look at the supervisor's credentials and licensure at the time in the states of which she was working. Everything seemed to align. She completed her application answering no for all for questions 1 through 7, 1 through 8. So there was nothing there. She is a BACB in good standing. She provided her documentation and her transcripts. Supervisors are all good standing. I see no issues with this application and would like to see it move forward to the board for full approval.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Davey. And Ms. Clark, if you have anything to say, you're welcome to say anything. Otherwise, thanks for being here.
Just thank you. That's all.
All right. All right, next application is Kayla Siegfried. I am the reviewer for that, lead for that. Ms. Siegfried graduated in May of 2023 from St. Joseph University with a master's in special education and concentration in applied behavior analysis. She was certified as a BCBA in October of 23. She received 1,645.75 hours of supervision under multiple Arizona licensed behavior analysts. I did not know any concerns with that application and recommend that it be forwarded to the board for approval. All right. The next application we will consider is William Martin. And Dr. Dave, you're the lead on that.
Thank you.
And Mr. Martin is here as well.
That's great. And I believe, yes, Mr. Martin. So Mr. Martin went through, provided us an application for licensure. Going through the application, he has previously held a Tennessee Department of Health license as a behavior analyst, but that has since expired. He's also held a behavior specialist, in Pennsylvania, I believe that's more of a certification, that expired in 2014. Currently, from the application, I did not see that there were any current licenses in place. In completing the application, he does indicate that he's been a board-certified behavior analyst and has been a board-certified behavior analyst for quite some time, since May of 2014. I think that's important to note as we kind of get into the next step here, and that is around his supervised hours. And so if board members will remember, previously, we had Mr. Martin on the agenda, and we moved him off to be able to discuss the fact that he went through an intensive practicum, which was allowable back in, early on in, as the BACB numbers were beginning to grow. And so he noted in the information that he's unable to fully submit his application. And so typed in a couple of things, alerting us to allowing him to know that he could not do the supervision without 15 or could not complete the application in its entirety without the 1500 hours, noted as 750. Really going through the rest of the application, there are no other issues. I think one other thing I would point out is just that we, as a committee, you know, I think we invited Mr. Martin to come here and have a discussion around the 750. Our statute's quite clear, Mr. Martin. We have the requirement of 1500 hours in the state. And so with your attendance here today, I think we just wanted to maybe explore if there was other supervisory work that you had, you know, in, you know, 2015, 2014 timeframe, where an individual was supervising you, perhaps at a different position, previous position, that you could maybe demonstrate that through documentation to the committee to be able to move forward with the other 750 hours. Unfortunately, the board's hands are quite, or the committee's hands are quite tied in the recommendation to the board because of the way the statute's written. And you heard some of that early on, if you attended the beginning of this call coming from the legal counsel that's representing the state association.
Yeah, thank you. I went to an in-person program at the University of Pittsburgh and was supervised as part of a graduate coursework there for the 750 hours of intensive practicum, which was allowed in 2012 and 2013. So I practiced in North Carolina after that, and North Carolina used to have a similarly restrictive practice where you had to be supervised by a licensed psychologist to practice behavior analysis. So I was supervised by a BCBA LPA for a year when I worked there, but I don't have retaining documentation for that because I was already a board certified behavior analyst at the time, and that was more to meet the requirements of my employer there. So that did occur, but I you know, my certification was completed based on the requirements at the time and not the requirements of Arizona.
Hearing that, just, I mean, one of the things that you could potentially think about as an option is that if those were requirements were statute in North Carolina of like what you were required to do, then that would be memorialized somewhere that you could pull that through. And then perhaps trying to get a hold of that supervisor. Are you still in contact with that individual by chance?
Yeah, I know them and I could get in contact with them. I think I don't have documentation of individual meetings that occurred at the time. This was in 2014, so, you know, going on 10 years ago. And I now live in Colorado and have lived in Tennessee since then. So it's been quite some time. And I, you know, there was this three jobs ago, and so I don't have the records and kind of the calendar invitations and those sorts of things. So I'd be happy to reach out to Dr. Plattner, who is the person who provided that supervision. But I'm just not sure I could accurately generate those records given that it was 10 years ago.
Understood. And that's why I think it would be important maybe for us to understand what the requirements were in the state of North Carolina at that time.
Sure.
If essentially then if your supervisor could attest that you were in, and again, I can't guarantee what the other committee members or the full board will say, but giving us other documentation to kind of create the case that you were under supervision. And it sounds like under what was going on in North Carolina, that if we took a look perhaps at what that statute looked like at the time, and it articulated something that appeared that, you know, was in line with supervision, that, and we had an attesting from perhaps your supervisor, that maybe the committee could take that in its entirety and to be able to move your application forward. And I can't guarantee that. One of the reasons I wanted to talk to you and invited you today was to see what other board members had and to maybe share some thoughts with you.
Sure. I can describe the statute in North Carolina briefly, if that'd be helpful.
You can describe it, but I will just say the committee will want to see it in writing and most likely
okay.
Sending us a link and allowing us to opine or to review that along with our legal counsel and along with board staff. And then the discussion would happen at the CBA level and then on to the board after that.
Okay, understood.
Dr. Rates, do you have any further comments on this?
I would just agree with Dr. Davey. I think if we can get a statement from the previous supervisor and we can review the requirements of the state at the time, I would be comfortable moving in that direction as an option.
Yeah. I might propose one more possible option, but this would be maybe a lengthier option. We do have that possibility, and Ms. Galvin, you may correct me on this one, but a universal recognition. Well, your Tennessee license has expired. The possibility of becoming relicensed, but Ms. Galvin, I don't, or board staff, I don't know if that's even a reasonable option.
Dr. Stenhoff, that would require him to hold the license for a year in good standing in an outside state. But again, if he's licensed in Colorado and is going to, you know, or is going to get licensed in a different state that has licensure and holds that for a year, he could always come back through universal recognition.
And that would also require him to demonstrate that he is moved here.
Yeah.
An established residency here.
Yeah. Okay.
I just would want to question why I think the committee is searching for possible solutions to this. The statute still is very clear that 1500 hours is required. And that obviously is something that the committee and the board cannot deviate from.
Thank you.
I do have a question. I know that you can't take other professional practice into consideration given what Ms. Galvin just stated, but I certainly am not the only person who was certified, 10 years ago who's attempting to practice in Arizona. Is there other resolutions that the committee has come to in the situation of rectifying this, or is Arizona just are only folks who have been certified in the past, 5 years practicing in the state of Arizona.
Ms. Pakanon, I see your hand up.
Yes, Mr. Chair. So, this scenario has definitely been envisioned, for some time by the committee. There's been multiple meetings where the acknowledgement of, the very, the restrictive nature of this language, the committee recognizes, what that means and, the implications for how it must be applied and so forth. And there have been conversations around, can we not, remove that, ask the legislature with concurrence from the governor to remove it. And, if you were, able to follow or present for the earlier discussion, there really isn't the political, it isn't politically palatable at this time, unfortunately, but the committee raises it frequently. Interestingly, I can only recall one other instance in the over four years I've been supporting this, the committee and the board, where an individual, where the statute was relevant to their supervised experience. I don't remember how it was resolved, but I think what Dr. Davey, his line of questioning may have led to that particular applicant securing that sort of resolution or that that solution to her own application. Interestingly, this is not a terribly frequent occurrence, but it's a known issue.
And I would also just add, Mr. Chairman, that one of the resolutions is that people that come up short, whether it's 750 or 200 hours or 300 hours, they essentially go back through the supervision process through an agency in Arizona and accumulate those hours and then resubmit their application.
And if I could ask two clarifying questions, in the process that you described, Dr. Davey, would I be authorized to practice in Arizona under the supervision of another behavior analyst during that time?
Well, that's somewhat A different way to ask that question would be, could you practice independently as a behavior analyst? No, the answer is no. Can you be providing services as, let's just say, a behavior technician or a registered behavior technician level under a supervising LBA? Yes. So you could practice, but under the supervision of that individual at that level of an RPT, not as a behavior analyst.
And that would be restrictive in what sorts of activities you could engage in.
Yes.
I see. I'm sorry, the second question that I have, if that'd be okay, is I've also held a faculty position at Vanderbilt University for 5 years and was supervised by a behavior analyst as part of that work. We were, you know, I was leading a team of folks in an NIH grant. I know you can't consider that as competence, even though I think maybe you should. But I could also potentially speak with that person who, you know, provided weekly supervision as part of our, you know, job activities at the university. If that would be, again, I can't recreate exactly the dates and times of those meetings, but I can describe the supervisory nature in what I would describe a high quality care environment, if that would be tenable. And that was 5 years of supervision on a weekly basis, if helpful in any way.
Mr. Martin, go ahead, Dr. Nagy.
I was just going to respond to that. I would just say that the important part there is, you know, it's not just about being supervised by the HR sense of it, right? Like, you would need to be able to say that you were conducting behavior assessments, designing and implementing and monitoring skill acquisition or behavior reduction programs, overseeing behavior analytic programs, training, designing analytical behavior systems and management performance. Like, you would, you know, within the application, there's 12 questions that a supervisor would have to attest to, yes, for that to occur. And so I would just, you know, point you towards that before, you know, as you think about who you might be able to speak to with regard to being able to check off the supervision. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Pakenham? Oh, yeah, Dr. David. Ms. Pakenham?
So I'm trying to think about, you know, how our licensing application timeframes come into play, because they are a factor. And I'm wondering, this question is mostly for Ms. Galvin. So what I'm hearing is that there may be some opportunity for Mr. Martin to potentially gather other documentation. So the way that could be facilitated would be through a FAIR. And the FAIR does allow a very generous amount of time for that purpose. If what comes back to this committee in response to the FAIR still doesn't provide the assurance that his supervised experience meets the standards established by board statute, I think a second FAIR could be issued at that point in time that would give, and I think it's 240, 280 days. It's a pretty substantial amount of time. If the only other possible solution is to acquire additional supervised hours of experience, I have no idea whether that 280 or whatever it is, you know, effectively facilitates the acquisition of 750 hours or whatever the balance ends up being. But I'm just thinking about how we execute the next steps. I think a FAIR is necessary now, and a contemplation of a second FAIR may be needed depending on the outcome of the first FAIR. Does that make sense?
Yes, and I would agree with you. After the first FAIR and any subsequent documentation that's received, I would imagine the committee and the board would also be willing to allow him to withdraw the application without any penalty, to allow him to obtain additional supervision hours. If the issuance of a second FAIR would not give him enough time to obtain those hours.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Galvin. So fortunately, Zakiya is consulting the rule and coaching me. So it's 240 days per FAIR. So there could be up to 480 days. Wow, that's pretty generous, you know, for the acquisition of the balance of the hours. So I just wanted to raise that so everyone understands how this could be facilitated.
Thank you, Ms. Pacman. So, Mr. Martin, it sounds like there is some possibilities out there for you to explore. And as if proposed, or if the committee agrees, then a request for additional information will be submitted to you, and you'll have a list of what you need to do. Yeah, Dr. Davey. So, Dr. Davey, any further comments on this?
Okay. I don't. So, I just wanted to thank the committee for the discussion.
Yeah. And Mr. Martin, thank you for being here. Much appreciated. Well, it seems like there's still some things for you to do. It still was helpful, and hopefully it was helpful for you to kind of get an understanding of what needs to happen moving forward too.
Yeah, I appreciate the time. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay. Next application is Amy Ayali. And I am the lead on that. Ms. Ayala was responding to a first formal additional information request that she complete the board's multiple supervisors at one organization forum, providing the names, dates, and hours of supervision for all her supervisor. She did complete the form, giving her a total sum of 1,523 hours, satisfying the requirements for licensure. In that case, I recommend that her application be moved forward to the board for approval. Okay. The next application we will consider is Cole Hartson. Dr. Raitz, you're the lead on that. I do need to disclose that I was Mr. Hartson's professor for several of his classes while he attended ASU, but I feel that I can hear this application without any bias.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the applicant comes to us having completed their master's at ASU in May of 23. They received their board certification in October of 23. All supervision occurred at Hope Ridge between September of 21 and September of 23 for a total of 2,010 hours. This was all under the supervision of a LBA here in the state. I did not see any issue with the application and would recommend that we move it forward to the full board.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Reitz. The next application we'll review is Mark Violetti. Dr. Davey, you're the lead on that. Oh, Dr. Davey, I believe you're muted.
I was trying to be so polite as the printer was going off. Thank you, Dr. Stenhoff. Mr. Violetti comes forward seeking licensure in the state of Arizona, completed his application in its entirety. He was supervised in the state of California by a couple of different agencies. As we know, California does not have licensure. Both of his supervisor, or all of his supervisors, were in good standing with the BACB in terms of their certification as well as their ability to supervise. Questions 1 through 8 on the declarations were all responded to no, and I have no concerns with this application. Would like to see it move forward.
Okay, thank you. Next application we'll review is Luana Guardado, Dr. Rachel Lee.
Mr. Chair, for this applicant, this was a response to additional information request. We had questions regarding the graduation date as well as supervision. The individual did clarify their graduation date as the end of January and submitted documentation for that. They also indicated they had 7 supervisors. All of the supervision logs were provided. It did meet all of our requirements. And all of that supervision did occur in California under individuals who are in good standing. So with that additional information, I think we can move this forward to the full board.
Thank you. Next application is Desiree Hanna. Dr. Davey, you're the lead on that.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Ms. Hannah comes forward seeking licensure in the state of Arizona, provided us a complete application with regard to her employment and previous experience. Nothing out of the ordinary in this particular application. Supervision was conducted here in the state of Arizona, and all supervisors listed for the agencies were in good standing. Questions 1 through 8, again, were all answered negative in terms of our declarations. You will note that there is some time where we went between two different centers and then returned to one of the previous centers. No real issues there, and the numbers and the supervision periods and the licensure periods for the supervisors look good. I'd like to see this move forward to the full board.
All right, thank you, Dr. Davey. Next application we'll review is Darren Hansen. Dr. Rich, you're the lead on that?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I told you I might get stuck with my screen, so thank you. For this individual, again, this was a request for additional information related to the work that the individual reported. They clarified that all of the work was done in Texas. They were licensed at the time. So with that, I believe that we can move this forward to the full board.
Okay. And next application, Dr. Reitz, will have you take this as well. But this is Carrietta Guadio.
One moment while I pull it up. Okay. This applicant comes to us having completed their master's degree at Simmons University in May of 2005. They received their board certification in September of 2013. They indicated that they are also licensed by the Department of Ed in Florida in good standing. Supervision all occurred between October of 2011 and July of 2013 for a total of 1,500 hours. Under a supervisor that met our requirements. So I did not see any issue with this application and would recommend that we move it forward.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Reitz. And Ms. Hansen, I see your hand is up. Did you have a comment?
I just wanted to out that my name was misspelled on there. I know on my application it was correct, so I just want to make sure that it's correct on my license.
Okay, and could you, what was incorrect on here?
My last name is spelled Henson, H-E-N-S-O-N.
Got it, okay. And I do note on your application it is S-O-N, so I think we're good. But thank you for that clarification. That'd be an important clerical piece to have in there. Appreciate it. Okay, so next application is Taryn Skull. And let's see, Dr. Dave, you're the lead on that.
Thank you, Mr. Stenhoff. And I will start with a disclosure that Ms. Skull recently joined the organization for which I work for. However, I have no direct supervisory responsibilities over Ms. Skull, and so feel as if I can adjudicate this without bias. Ms. Scholl comes forward seeking licensure in the state of Arizona. She has, interestingly, been a special education teacher and held a license for real estate. Also, since moving in Arizona, has been engaged with a couple of different agencies to be able to receive her supervision. She was also a registered behavior technician before moving into completing her BCBA coursework and subsequently successfully passing the exam. Her declarations were all answered no. Her transcripts were in order, and she also has listed out her supervisors. All were in good standing during the time frame of supervision, both by the state as well as the BACB. I'd like to see this move forward to the full board for approval.
All right, thank you, Dr. Davey. And I note somebody with the initial CLG has his or her hand up. Would you care to address the committee?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Perfect. Hi, this is Kayla Yetagadio. Dr. Waits had just reviewed my application. I wanted to thank her for that. I don't know if it mattered. I do have an EDD degree from Nova Southeastern University. I know I submitted it. It just wasn't on the agenda. So I just wanted to make sure the EDD was correct because all of my coursework was done in that program.
Okay.
Thank you for that. Yes, I did. I did leave that out in my review. So I appreciate you.
Okay. No, I just wanted to make sure that it was accurate. Okay. Okay. Yes. I appreciate it. Thank you so much. I so appreciate you.
All right. Thank you for being here. Appreciate it. Ms. Malice.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to give the next code word, and that is bachelor. Bachelor. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Madison. Okay. So we will be returning, moving to the top of the list and down. So the next application is Christine Rigaldo, and I am the lead on that. So Ms. Rigaldo responded to a first formal additional information request, verification of additional of 110 hours of supervised experience that meet Arizona's requirements. She provided a final verification form from the VACB indicating an additional 190.75 hours by an Arizona LBA, satisfying the additional 110 requested by the Committee on Behavior Analysts. Thus, I recommend that it be forwarded to the board for approval. All right. Next is Clarissa Jackson. Dr. Rates, you're the lead on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This was a request for additional information. We had questions related to supervision for the applicant. The applicant confirmed that they did initially have a supervision contract with a Kevin, will not be able to correctly pronounce the last name. That supervision did not last long. And then additional supervision was provided by both Ann O'Brien and Annika O'Connor. The applicant did share all of the supervision logs for a total of 1,509 hours. The individual that signed that was the representative for that company. And all of that did occur in California. So with that, I think that has resolved the questions that we had, and we can move this forward.
All right. Dr. Reitz. Next application is Michaela Anderson. I'm the lead on that. Ms. Anderson graduated May of 2023 from Arizona State University with a master's in special education and concentration in applied behavior analysis. She was certified as a BCBA in October of 23. She received 1,511.5 hours of supervision under an Arizona licensed behavior analyst. I didn't note any concerns with this application. Recommend that we move forward to the board for approval. And then our next application is Grace Lee. Dr. Davey, you're the lead.
Yes, thank you very much. And Grace Lee is a follow-up to something the committee reviewed previously, for those that might recall. With regard to the application, the question really came to the issue where we requested clarification about the supervision that occurred at the Center for Autism and Related Disorders. We also asked for clarification as to when one of the individuals listed on the supervisor form completed their supervision training. And then we also sought verification of an additional 259 hours of supervised experience that met Arizona's requirements under AAC R426-404.2. In response to this affair, we received information back from Ms. Lee, where she described her supervision experience. She also provided us an updated multiple supervisor form that also has additional details in the footnotes that describe how she was in Texas and under supervision of Texas LBAs and BCBAs. She talked about the time when she moved to Arizona at 11/28 of 2022, had a short gap during which she was not doing therapy or collecting hours, and then restarted supervision under Julie Daniel 12/7 to 12/22 until March 10th of 2023. Julie Daniels is now added up there for the 180.11 hours. Also supervision contract with Emily Patton, who is also listed as Arizona licensed behavior analyst. And that contract ran from 3/9 on the form, 3/10 in the footnotes of 2023 to 4/28/2023. And on the, that's from the footnotes, according to the form, it actually ran from 3/9, as I said, to 7/5, so a little bit further, but accumulating, only adding about 58 hours during that time frame. They removed supervision hours from the previous one for both Brittany Keeler and Karen Noletti, and has provided supplemental documentation for the additional 317.51 hours under supervision of the Brianna Carco and Tina Vu that met the Arizona, that meet Arizona requirements. And so with all of this, committee members, I believe we have clarified the 1500 hours. I believe we have clarified the question around the individual's supervision or the individual's Ms. Ryan's time where she completed her her BACB requirement to be able to supervise. I'm going to see if I flag that on a page down here. But board staff, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe I scanned it through the PDF. I thought I had it bookmarked. But Ms. Ryan, supervision was completed on 12/12 of 2014. And so that seems to be in line. So I believe that we've satisfied, I believe the applicant satisfied the request for the FAIR. Has done her diligence in cleaning up her application with regard to including only licensed behavior analysts for the state of Arizona, which was in question, and has provided an additional 259 hours, slightly over, for the supervised experience that failed to meet Arizona's requirements. And now with the additions and the clarifications and addition that now does meet. But I will defer to any of my other board members if they have any questions or comments around the application, as there was a lot of things going on.
Dr. Davey, I did not note any others. I know we have an agenda item coming up that's going to address some of the supervision issues, agenda item number 8, but regarding her application, I'm comfortable moving forward to.
Yeah, and I think the individuals on 8, those names have been removed from the multiple supervisors form. Yeah. So there's no more Ms. Keeler or no more Ms. Nolte. I'm going to mess it up, but we'll go with Nohelty listed.
And I do know Ms. Keeler, your hand is up. So.
Yes, I provide supervision to individuals that are in Arizona. Currently. So I just want to make sure we don't make mistakes in the future and make sure that's allowed. Of them are, their primary supervisor will always be a licensed Arizona behavior analyst, of course, but we provide supplementary supervision to increase the quality of that supervision by providing small group sessions. And I won't waste your time going into more detail, but it's like a curriculum that we like to run.
Yeah. Well, Ms. Keeler, we'll come back and address that. We're going to have to finish up this agenda item first, but we'll more specifically address that here in a few minutes when we get to that item. Okay.
Oh, no problem. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
So without any additional feedback, Dr. Stenhoff and Dr. Waits, I think we can move this one forward for approval.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Davey. Next application is Rachel Vargas. I am the lead on that. Ms. Vargas graduated in November of 2016 from National University with a master's in teaching and specialization in applied behavior analysis. She was certified as a BCBA in October of 2018. At the time, she received 1,691.75 hours of supervision under a BCBA in California, which does not require licensure. I did not know any concerns with the application, recommended it move forward to the board for approval. Next application is Nicholas Carter, and Dr. Reitz, you're the lead on that.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. The applicant comes to us having completed a master's degree at Ball State in December of 2020. They received their board certification in June of 23. They completed supervision by two different supervisors, but a total of 1,504 by an LBA here in Arizona. So they do meet that requirement. I didn't note any issues with the application and would recommend that we move that forward to the full board.
Okay, thank you. Next application is Alexander Paulson-Hodia. Mr. Paulson-Hodia graduated in November 2016 from Arizona State University with a master's in curriculum instruction and emphasis in applied behavior analysis. He was certified as a BCBA in November of 2019 and received 1,530 hours of supervision under a BCBA in California. I didn't note any concerns and recommend that it move forward to the board for approval. The next application we'll review is Jacqueline Para. I'm also the lead on that. Ms. Para graduated in May of 2023 from University of Arizona with a master's in special education. She was certified as a BCBA in October of 2023 and received 2,004 hours of supervision under an Arizona licensed behavior analyst. And I recommend that this also move forward to the board for approval. The next application we'll review is Dominic Gary. Dr. Dave, you're the lead on that one.
Thank you so much. So I would just point committee members to some of the information that's provided on this application, be able to follow along as we discuss. Individual comes forward seeking licensure in the state of Arizona, was supervised in California for their BACB work. Declarations were all responded to as no. Individual's in good standing with the BACB and has been certified since 2019. A couple of things of note. One, transcripts that were provided to us were not provided by the university. These transcripts were submitted directly by the applicant, as that's noted by Z on the application. And part of that is around, and that is through Capella University. And I'm not sure if what the issue there was, if it's that Capella is no longer able to produce these or what the issue might have been. But it did not come from a direct source. Additionally, we have verification forms that were submitted by the applicant that show that the 1500 hours was completed. Where things get interesting is with regard to the supervisors, all three supervisors, one appears to be in Missouri and two others in California, have failed to be able to respond back to the attempts of the licensee to be able to get additional information with regard to their supervision experience. And so the application or the applicant has provided us with dates of the contact attempts with each of the individuals that is documented on page 19, 2021. In particular, 2021 has a list of who was tried to connect, who the applicant tried to connect with via email. And then, So a lot to kind of unpack there with regard to what we would need to discuss to feel comfortable moving this forward. So official transcripts one issue, and just want to make sure we're, you know, maybe board staff can talk to us if there's some compelling reason why we weren't able to get official ones and we had to receive them sent over. And maybe then we can go from there.
Ms. Pakenham?
Yes, Mr. Chair. So I think what we were hoping to accomplish was for the applicant, Ms. Gary, to be present today, because perhaps the committee articulating to her the necessity of the transcripts being issued by the institution, directly from the institution to us, is a requirement. It seems that for whatever reason, Ms. Malice's attempts to impart that understanding on the applicant, they've been unsuccessful. Notwithstanding that, I really don't have anything else to offer. I mean, what the committee sees relative to the results or absence of results with her attempts to secure her supervised experience documentation. I don't have anything else to add, but maybe Ms. Gary, if she's not here, I don't see her anyway, she will listen to the recording of this meeting. And, you know, maybe if articulated emphatically by the committee, she'll understand the transcripts requirement.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's not just also the transcripts. I think I would also want to hear like what the hang up is with the supervisors as well. I mean, I realize that we don't have jurisdiction over Missouri and California, but we have in the past attempted to compel supervisors to respond to requests to be able to assist individuals to be able to get their license under current BACB guidelines with regard to complying with requests from regulators. And so I'd like to hear about those attempts to see if that's something we also need to move forward with. So is it possible to kind of put a stay on this and revisit it? And perhaps did we invited Ms. Lee, I assume, or not Ms. Lee, I'm sorry, I kind of crossed up, but Mr. Gary to appear. Do we feel like was there any indication back to board staff of a response to that overture on our part?
So I'm going to let, there's been some recent correspondence that Ms. Malice is summarizing it to me. I'd rather Ms. Malice speak to what the most recent correspondence between her and the applicant consists of, because it seems that there is there's a curious amount of a disconnect, you know, just not understanding what we are as staff are trying to impart upon her. So Ms. Malice, will you brief the committee about the most recent conversations you've had with the applicant?
Yes. The applicant sent me an email this morning and she asked about where does she send her application. I think that she thinks that her application is closed because she was up to the deadline on her original application. But I sent her the information about the meeting and I told her she's on the agenda, but I have not had any confirmation that she's attending, because I think that she thinks that because the email that's in the application packet where I said, today is the deadline for your application. So I, for some reason, she thinks her application is closed, but it is not. So I don't know why she didn't get her transcript sent over, and I don't know why she's not in attendance. But she just, I don't know why she thinks that her application is closed and she needs to submit a new application.
So, Ms. Packenham, what's your recommendation?
Mr. Chair, Dr. Davey, I'm struggling here because it seems a little bit of an extreme act to subpoena the applicant to compel her to come before the committee to help her comprehend what it is that I'm confident is being communicated to her and articulated to her quite clearly. But that's your prerogative, of course, to we'll issue the subpoena if you think that that is necessary. For whatever reason, email communications have been effective. So she seems to still be motivated and interested in establishing she's qualified to be licensed
in Arizona. So I don't know if just a formal letter to her informing her that an interview with the board or a conversation with the board really is necessary. She needs to be at the February CBA meeting. Maybe that's adequate and we don't need to go to the extreme of a subpoena. So I identify those two options because I'm not sure what else we can do.
Yeah. So we've clearly articulated that we need transcripts sent from the school. There's no barrier that we've identified on our end that should stop this individual from doing that or that's been articulated to us. So I think that that's something that I believe the applicant could handle before February. And then really, if that's the case, the February discussion could be around her inability to compel her supervisors to respond. And we could have that conversation and perhaps move forward. So I'm fine with a letter. Like, it does seem odd to subpoena someone who's trying to become licensed to come, you know, subpoena them to help them navigate this. And I do believe that we're providing adequate support to our soon to be licensees. I mean, we have 20 people on the agenda today and 40 some the week before or the month before. So that does become a little bit curious as to attention to detail for sure.
Yeah. So the letter would, it would be a fair. Just wanted to clarify that. So the fair would include everything that you've identified. You may as well include, the information that we, in the fair, identify what is deficient about the documentation that she has not submitted relative to her supervised experience. But the fair will also articulate the need for the transcripts to come from the issuing institution directly to us. And then the third item in the fair will be her presence for an application interview.
Yeah.
And if she doesn't show at that meeting or hasn't requested the transcripts, then you could let her know that her application file will be closed. She's not cooperating.
Yeah. Sounds right on.
Anything further, Dr. Davey?
Nothing further from my end.
Okay. All right. Let's see. We'll do our universal recognition, and then we will make a motion for the application. So, Batul Dekmek, Dr. Rates, you're the lead on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This individual was able to meet all of our requirements, has a license in Michigan in good standing, also provided proof of residency in review. I didn't note any issue of concern and would recommend that we move this forward.
Note on here, I just want to make sure it's accurate. Is there, Ms. Galvin or board staff, I'm looking at the Michigan license, and it appears it's expired in November of 23. Is there any issue with that? Because if her application was submitted before that, would that allow for continuation, or?
Ms. Malice, do you, I know we've had an applicant situation that presented that was the virtually identical facts and circumstances. In that case, do you recall if the committee and board determined that if the application date preceded the expiration date of the license in the other jurisdiction, if the statute allows us to accept that, or if we had to advise the applicant to reinstate the lapsed expired license in the other jurisdiction to be eligible? And that's really a legal question for Ms. Galvin too. It appears that the application was submitted on November 30th, 2023.
So it had expired prior to the application.
Okay.
Because the expiration date is November 5th of 2023, so it'd be about 25, well, 25 days prior. Well, Ms. Galvin, you're muted.
So it appears that it was not current at the time that she submitted her application.
Yeah.
And I was wrong about the date. It's actually October 10 that she submitted the application. And I think that what we are arriving at is that a reinstatement will be required. So that's not necessarily a daunting or complex proposition, but we have no way of knowing that what another jurisdiction requires. Generally, it isn't, but she'll have to evaluate that with Michigan.
Let's see. Yeah, it requires a current license in another state.
So
we need to issue a fair letter in this instance.
Yeah.
So there's a possibility that, I mean, we don't need to go there at this time, but there's a possibility she could submit an application under what would, I guess, regular, I don't know,
application. I'm sorry. I really need Ms. Malice to speak up because when I speak up, I don't have the right facts. So Ms. Malice is messaging me that she actually did reinstate the applicant or the Michigan license. So okay. I assume she went online and verified that the new Michigan expiration date is November 5, 2027.
Oh. All right. So, Dr. Reyes, what were you saying?
I was going to say that we need to issue her more information, but it sounds like we have that now. So does she need to submit documentation of that, or is our review of the license enough?
Given the subsequent information that Ms. Malice has conveyed to Ms. Pakanon, it appears that she does have that license. It was reinstated. It's been active and in good standing for at least 1 year. So you would have the information you need to determine whether she qualifies.
Is there a way to see, I guess it's called Laura, whatever. My only question is, I guess, more of a legal question, right? Like, she's had to have an active license for a year, right? If it was inactive for a week, does that change us? I mean, I know the universal recognition piece is difficult to navigate sometimes, and we've had multiple discussions over the course of the years. So I'm just nervous of
the and Ms. Mellis, she stated that it was reinstated. So does that go back to, when it was lapsed? Is there a grace period from that state?
So Ms. Mellis can upload what she's showing to me, which is a screenshot of Laura's website that reflects that the original license issue date was 11/5/2019. License expiration date 11/5/2027. So she will upload that, give her a couple of minutes, and then refresh your folder, and then you will be able to see that, Dr. Davey and members. And it's been emailed to you as well.
It doesn't appear that there was a break in licensure based on that. Otherwise, the new date would be, something other than 11/5/2019.
Oh, perhaps. Okay, so according to documentation, where she has not labbed.
It does not appear that way. You could go ahead and grant the application, maybe perhaps pending confirmation, if Ms. Mellis could reach out to the state and confirm that there was no break in active licensure.
Okay. All right. So, so Dr. Rates, are you okay with Ms. Galvin's break? Okay. So, given that, let's do we have a motion for agenda item number 7 regarding the applications?
I'll move that we put those forward to the full board.
Okay. All right, with the noted fair and et cetera with those.
Yeah, do we need to call the fairs? The ones that need fairs obviously will remain. And definitely Mr. Gary will remain.
Board staff, is that noted? All those? Okay. All right. Then do I have a second?
I will second.
Okay, further discussion? All right. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. All right. Next agenda item number 8, discussion and possible action regarding supervision services provided to Arizona applicant for licensure by individuals not licensed as behavior analysts in Arizona. Ms. Pakkinen, you're the lead on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As was noted just a few moments ago, relative to the application of Grace Lee, when the committee initially conducted the substantive review of this application, it was noted that she had identified two supervisors who had supplied a total of, I believe it was, 193.29 hours of supervision under one supervisor, and also 66.17 hours from another supervisor, neither of whom are licensed in Arizona. On that application, Ms. Lee had made a notation. She had qualified to some degree the supervision role that these two individuals occupied, which they did not oversee therapy, but were associated with the company fellowship program. And so that comment wasn't, I think, didn't provide the clarity that the committee needed in order to determine whether the activities in which the two BCBAs in California engaged, whether or not those constitute any violations of Arizona's statutes. And so we know that the statute 32-2091.03 requires that supervised experience acquired in Arizona be under the under a behavior analyst license in Arizona. And so I've also supplied to inform the committee's discussion today some definitions from your statutes relative to behavior analyst, how that's defined by law in Arizona, how a supervisee is defined by law in Arizona, and then also a statute for your reference that addresses unlicensed practice in our state. And so the committee directed me to contact the two California supervisors, the two BCBAs, and invite them to this meeting for purposes of providing you with the clarification that we were unable to discern from Ms. Lee's application. They have both confirmed they would attend, and I see they are both present today, Brittany Keeler and Karen Nolte.
And
do you have any questions for me?
Oh, yeah, committee, does anybody have any questions for Ms. Packer? And Ms. Keeler, I know I had to hold off till this agenda item. Would you, I guess, you and if Ms. Nohelty and Ms. Nohelty, if I'm pronouncing your name incorrectly, please let me know. But would Ms. Keeler, I guess, since you were talking earlier, would you mind starting off and just kind of giving us the nature of that supervision?
Yes, and I apologize for the interruption earlier. That was a misspeak on my behalf. Yes, absolutely. So CARD is a big organization. We provide ABA services to multiple states across the country, and we do absolutely try our best to follow all licensure requirements and keep up to date with that. But I would be lying if I said I know all of the little ins and outs of licensure for Arizona. So what the nature of the supervision is we noticed as a company that there was a lack of quality supervision across the board for the people that are going for, you know, studying to be a BCBA. So we designed what's called a fellowship program, which is a, we have about 50 fellows at a time. We bring them into small group meetings to work through items in the task list, doing a mixture of unrestricted activities, basically, that are within the BACB guidelines for those activities. So we do, mock FBAs together. We're going through how to troubleshoot different, issues that might come up with cases just to simplify matters. We give, in my class, we do mock cases where I'm using real data from patients, with all of the PHI redacted, of course. And then they are treatment planning for those, and we're doing feedback regularly. They take those unrestricted activities and the work that they, the permanent product, so to speak, that's completed is reviewed both by me and given feedback. And then also with their primary BCBA, who's the licensed Arizona BCBA, is the one signing off on all these hours. So it's part of the program that they are actively involved in the work done for the fellowship so that all of that fits. And I apologize that we weren't approved to provide that level of supervision. We thought we met the exemption number 4 that we can do this. A person who resides outside of the state who is currently licensed or a certified behavior analyst under the exemptions for licensure, we thought we met that requirement. So any explanation on your guys' end to make sure that we either stop providing supervision to Arizona mentees or we can do this with that exemption. Karen Nolte's class is a little bit different. She's part of the fellowship, or she was. She's no longer with CARD, unfortunately. But her component of it was really looking at experimental design and the research component and unrestricted activities related to that. So I was the clinical programming piece. She was in all the other areas of the task list. She was dedicated to experimental design. So, okay, sorry. You probably have questions.
Does any committee members have questions for either of these two?
Yes, Dr. Stanoff. And so I think what I need some clarification is around your discussion of the unrestricted activities that you're discussing in these settings, right? Mm-hmm. So I heard you say two different things. I heard one, you said, you know, that you are discussing cases with this group. I heard one that you said you're discussing mock cases with this group. I heard one where you're saying you're taking data from existing clients and pulling out all the PHI and using it as a learning opportunity. Mm-hmm. But as I think about unrestricted activities, that is data systems, conducting assessments, writing FBA reports, analyzing, interpreting data, supervising, you know, training staff, evaluating, modifying interventions. Mm-hmm. Are you providing that sort of guidance around the attendees to your classes around their cases?
Yes, absolutely. So we do both. We have mock patients and we have discussions about their patients that they work with and relating the topics to that. Because of all the restrictions with insurance requirements and these people being able to do super unrestricted activities while billing, not billing, all of that, won't get into the nitty gritty. This is a great way to meet the best of both worlds, where they're getting more than just, they're doing more than just restricted activities, right? They're really meeting that 60% requirement at a higher level than they would be if they were doing it during their therapy sessions. And I think it's more ethical to do it this way because we're not taking away from the patient's therapy session to have these unrestricted activities being done. So yes, they do assessments. They do the FBAs, they do treatment planning, problem solving, they do it with the mock patients. And then we also are layering that into their current patients that they work with and doing the restricted hours for in conversations with them.
Well, let me ask a much more direct question. So in these classes, if someone comes to you and they're talking about, so let's just say that we're not getting enough behavior change for an individual, and you look at the report and you say, you know what, why don't we go ahead and change up from a DRO to a DRA? Or why don't we change the reinforcement schedule from, you know, a fixed ratio to some sort of other interval to be able to move things forward? Is that the kind of feedback you're giving around cases?
In our one-to-one meetings, yes. The program is structured to be two small group meetings that are more topic-based and going over those mock examples. And then our individual meetings, we work on their specific cases. So it's kind of a full circle of both things. And when they do... Oh, sorry.
No, sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead.
When they do come to case-specific examples, like the one that you just provided, I'll give the recommendation and feedback, and they'll write up the example on unpaid time for them because they're not actually billing to the patient or providing support. They take that to the licensed BCBA and say, hey, this is something that we talked about, and you know, what do you think? And that licensed BCBA is always the one actually making the decision to go forward with it. But the mentee or the fellow, whatever you want to call them, is getting this experience of learning like options for change and what to do, and then actually getting that live feedback from their BCBA with that patient as well. So it really helps to, like I said, increase the quality of their supervision and what they get access to during that time.
So I think an important distinction here is not the quality of what you're providing or the rationale behind providing additional guidance, additional training. That's not the issue. The issue at hand for the committee, or at least for myself, is in doing so, are you practicing in the state of Arizona?
No. I'm not practicing in the state of Arizona because I'm not actually making treatment recommendations for that patient. I'm discussing recommendations with a fellow that might be appropriate for that patient. The actual Arizona licensed BCBA makes all the decisions, and they don't even have to take what I say at all. The fellow in some cases might not even have that follow-up. I hope they do. But no, I'm not billing to any patients in Arizona. I'm not, I mean, our company does provide consultation to cases in Arizona, but we're not BCBAs that are licensed are the ones that make the final decisions on everything.
So my question remains, right? So you say to this individual that's in your class, hey, change the reinforcement schedule. Mm-hmm. They go out and change the reinforcement schedule.
They cannot. They have to take that to their BCBA, who then might change the reinforcement schedule.
So there is someone in between you and them.
Yes, every time, 100%. Mm-hmm. And that actually goes for the case, not just for licensed BCBAs, that goes for the case in California too. And I make a recommendation to a California fellow who's talking to me about a case, they would take that to their BCBA, and that BCBA is solely responsible for changes for their patients on their treatment plan. The issue is that CARD is a big company, and all of our senior level clinicians are corporate employees like myself and like Karen was at CARD. And we like to provide this upper level training to our newer BCBAs and all of the people at our company. So I'm part of the training department ultimately, right? But I don't make direct decisions for these patients. That all should come from always their direct BCBA.
I'll pause there and let committee members maybe ask some questions they have. Thank you for your responses. I appreciate them.
Dr. Race, do you have any questions?
I don't think I have questions. I'm just reflecting.
Ms. Dalty, would you characterize, you know, Ms. Keeler indicated that you were mainly looking at design. Would you characterize your interactions as similar to Ms. Keeler's with what? Okay.
Yeah. Short answer is yes. I'll kind of give a little bit more information. When I was at CARD, I served as the director of research. And my portion within the fellowship was to, as Brittany Keeler stated, to support experimental design and really the task list items that are focused on research. I forget the exact Castles items, but you know, can detail them out. I have that information documented somewhere. So I was providing support in terms of, you know, we were looking at research articles and really focusing with the fellows on how to put research into practice, how you can read research and take the clinical information out of it so that hopefully when they're on their cases and when these fellows are future BCBAs, that they can read research articles, take information from that, apply it to their clinical practice. And similar to Ms. Taylor, I was not providing any recommendations for changes that the fellows would make on their cases. We would discuss options, potential ways in a more broad sense. And every now and then a fellow would have a question about a specific case. And I would provide general guidance and always direct them back to their local BCBA for that final decision.
Thank you. Committee members, any further questions?
I mean, I guess what I'm struggling with, right, is like I understand the purpose of the setup. I understand the tasks that are being discussed. I understand the rationale for improving services. I think the part that I'm struggling with is, you know, the definitions that Ms. Pakkinen has provided us and that are part of our definitions under 32.2091, you know, defines behavior analysis in a very specific way. You know, it defines it as the design and implementation and evaluation of systematic environmental modifications by a behavior analyst to produce socially significant improvements, right, in human behavior. And so the part I'm struggling with is what I'm hearing. And maybe it's you know, what I'm hearing is that, yes, we are engaged in that, in these activities. We are talking about design and implementation and the evaluation of areas. But that we're having these discussions, you know, as more of a teacher or the guide, and that information then is being run through local jurisdictions and local BCBAs, local licensed behavior analysts, you know, to decide whether or not said suggestions or said modifications are being run. And Dr. Rates said it, you know, I'm kind of reflecting, like, where's the line? Because I'm concerned of a slippery slope here, right? Of, you know, at what point does being a consultant or being someone who provides the recommendation become practice? And per our definitions, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're the decider, right? I mean, it's talking about the design and implementation and evaluation. And to me, it sounds like that's what's going on in these classes. And so I think I'm still, I probably need a moment to to digest everything I'm hearing.
I would argue that the change happens with the documentation in the patient's treatment plan. So I might consult about a DRA program that's implemented and might be appropriate for a patient that I've just been given a description of and how that's maybe something I would look at for that case. The mentee can come up with a mock version of how they would write that out as good practice. But the actual practice of ABA in Arizona would come from when the BCA makes that modification to that treatment plan. And in no situation does this fellow actually make, or myself, go into the treatment plan to make the change. So it's more, I guess I would question, if we didn't do it this way, with all of the insurance restrictions that we have, how would our mentees and fellows get high quality access to unrestricted activities? That definitely would be a conundrum. And I want to be respectful of the board, and I am 100% confident neither me or Karen were practicing ABA with patients directly in Arizona. We have been provided appropriate BACB supervised hours. And if Arizona fellows can't be part of this program because of the decision by the board, that is absolutely okay. And we will cease to have Arizona because you guys are concerned about that. I want to respect the legislation and all of those things that I don't fully understand. I'll respect that, and we can make sure Arizona fellows are no longer a part of the program. But if this is an issue of us practicing, I am, like I said, 100% confident we are not practicing in Arizona with patients in Arizona.
Dr. Davey?
Yes. And so, well, I think, oh, go ahead.
Well, I wanted to just make a comment. I'm comfortable that there's no practice going on, clinical practice going on, because the feedback is being given in a, I would say, a classroom arrangement of like, here's a problem going on. Here's a conversation to be had about what would you do sort of thing. It's an educational endeavor. Here's where precedence and definition come in, I think, and Ms. Galvin, and committee members may correct me, but we've had several agencies that provide supervision to supervisees, and they're not acting clinically, but they are nevertheless providing supervision to individuals who reside in the state of Arizona. And we have run into that. That's where the practice occurred. It was the practice of supervision, not the clinical practice. And with statute, that's how statute was described. You know, I think with the exception of higher education, I mean, you know, several months to years ago now, we had a university come in and clarify their practicum course to us. I believe that as a committee, that committee at the time was comfortable with what was going on. However, it was a university. And I don't know if that constitutes a difference or not, but I know more recently we've had these discussions, especially with these companies that are, their sole purpose is supervision. And there's been an issue with that. So I'm comfortable with the clinical side of it. There, it doesn't appear, at least in the description, that there's a clinical aspect going on. But practicing in how the statute has been written, supervision still is a practice of behavior analysis in the state of Arizona. Ms. Pacman?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I want to make sure that because it was alluded to, but I didn't hear that it was actually cited. So the exemptions from licensure statute is 32 2091.08, and the committee may need a few minutes with that.
So, Dr. Senef, as we kind of look at that, I think what I was kind of going through the definitions in a stepwise fashion, right? The practice is first, the supervision is second, right? And I think that is my next discussion, because I think, you know, with regard to names that are listed on even the fieldwork verification forms that are coming to us from in Ms. Lee's application, we at least see we see both individuals listed as supervisors under the accumulation of the 1,500 hours of Ms. Lee's application. And so the supervision piece to me is, you know, maybe easier one to navigate. I mean, to be very clear, supervision has to be done by an LBA in the state of Arizona, and that is required. Now, granted, we don't know, there's not a breakdown here of how many hours Ms. Keeler and Ms. Nolte did, but they're both listed on that document. And so that then kind of, you know, brings to the question to those on the call with us, Ms. Keeler, like, you know, how do you square up that side of the equation? So maybe the practice one, we can say, listen, you're not the one on the boots on the ground. You're not in the treatment plan. Talk to me about the supervision side of it.
The supervision meets the requirements for supervision under the BACB task list. So if it doesn't meet the Arizona it because it needs Arizona is putting the stipulation to be licensed in Arizona, you need that 1500 hours and we do not qualify for an exemption. Then how I get around that would be what Grace did is she removed all of the hours that Karen and I provided and she continued supervision after she passed her BCBA exam to remedy that. So if the board's decision is that we cannot supervise people in Arizona moving forward, and I apologize for our mistake for doing so in the past, then that's what we would do is our company would say they're not eligible for this program because it's going to interfere with their Arizona licensure once they're there, has to be supervised by the, you know, a licensed Arizona person. But in terms of the supervision we provide, it does follow the BACB guidelines and was appropriate for her to take her exam and pass it. So I think that's, I'm not sure if I answered your question. I hope so, but that would be my thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think you said two things there that are important, right? I think that one, yes, it does fit BACB guidelines. Like there's not, I don't have any issue with it. The issue is, yes, within the state of Arizona, it does not fit our guidelines.
And we don't fit the exemption that in that case, we don't meet that exemption requirement because I'm confused about the 20 days. So I'd ask for clarification on that. But item 4 does list that a person that resides out of the state who is currently licensed or certified, meeting all the state requirements, we're in good standing, all of that could be an exemption. So I guess that would be my question.
I'm not going to respond to the exemption piece right now, but we can have Ms. Galvin talk about that in a second. But I do want to point out a couple of things that you've said to me that just give me a little bit of concern as you go forward. And that is, you know, we started off this conversation with, I'm not sure, you know, I don't know everything about Arizona and I don't know everything. And that's somewhat problematic because you are operating in Arizona. And, you know, even if you don't like our rules and regulations in the state, the BACB compels you through the current code of ethics to be knowledgeable about and upholding BACB and other regulatory requirements. We are the other in this case. And so you are compelled to do that and to have that underneath your purview and your understanding. And it's not just the state of Arizona. It could be many of the states that your agency operates in that you need to be aware of those regulatory requirements because ultimately you're putting your supervisees at a disadvantage. You're putting them to come forward to us and you're hindering their ability to get licensed and for them to be able to serve the public here in Arizona. And that is the reason we're having the conversation today. So, you know, exemption aside, I think, you know, great that you know the exemption, great that we're pulling that out. But then the question becomes, are you only doing 20 days? How often did these meetings occur? How often did they occur? Both of you were listed on the verification form. How many hours was this over the course of that, right? It begs a bunch of other questions that, you know, need to be explored.
Mm-hmm. Can I respond a little bit with some of those details, so at least for my role with Grace Lee's supervision? In terms of the support that I provided with the fellowship, it was 6 1-hour meetings. So I saw Grace between January and June of 2022, and I saw her for a total of 6 hours. So I believe it was 66 supervised hours, so the remaining hours would have been indirect, unrestricted, sorry, hours. So that was my role in terms of the fellowship as it relates to Grace Lee.
And then the meetings that she has with me, there's 2 small groups and 1 individual meeting a month. So that could definitely exceed the 20 days. I would need to go back through my records and see how many months she was in full attendance, which I can do. But there may have been months she didn't attend all 3 meetings each month. But I hear your concerns, and I'd like to do what we can to remedy any concerns you have for us practicing supervision in Arizona and recommendations you have for us moving forward.
Well, I think the simple recommendation is that you need to be licensed. If you're going to provide supervision, you need to be licensed.
Okay. I started the process of licensure through Arizona. I was running into the issue of I've been a BCBA since 2012, but I don't have my original verification form anymore. And it didn't seem like it was necessary to complete my licensure under my role that I was in at the time. But absolutely, I think that makes a lot of sense. We were focused more on that the local jurisdiction would make sure that the practice of supervision and clinical work was happening there. We were providing supplementary support for supervision for them under the BACB guidelines. So you're right. That wasn't fully thought out. from that. And like I said, I hear your points, and I have noted them, and I'll make sure that we make changes moving forward.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Mr. Chair, I'd like to make a motion to go into executive session for the purpose of legal.
Do I have a second?
I'll second.
All in favor say aye.
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 Aye. We'll move to executive session. To have another word. I
yes, Mr. Chair. It's time for the next code word, which is wedding. Wedding.
Thank you. Let's see, Dr. Davies. Return to the ring.
He's joining right now.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Decided to leave the whole meeting. I apologize.
Welcome back to Grady. Okay, so Dr. Davy, would you any further questions or comments?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's any further questions. I think it's more of a deliberation discussion kind of section now.
Well, I mean,
do
you want to start, Dr. Davy, or I've got a few.
So yeah, go ahead, and then we'll go from there.
Okay, so there was practice without a license in the state. But as far as the clinical side, as I stated earlier, on the clinical side, there was not clinical decisions being made. The point of the activity was educational. And so I think to an extent that there's got to be a level of consideration with that. Although they're, you know, going back, I mean, the bottom line is there was practice, unlicensed practice. And so, so that's just, there was a kickoff right there. So we can start there and see what else we got to talk about.
So I think it's important, Dr. Stenhoff, that that Ms. Keeler and Ms. Nolte understand, like, that, yes, from Arizona regulation, the activities that you engaged in and the supervision you provided run afoul of our statutes and regulations. And, could have put an applicant, you know, further, like at least delayed this applicant 30 days, could have delayed the applicant even further in terms of getting services into the state and getting them licensed as a behavior analyst. I agree with Dr. Stenhoff's point of like the idea of clinical practice not going on, but the idea that supervision practice was occurring. I think that I appreciate the verbal discussion. I appreciate the verbal description of the things that you're willing to do to rectify this and to move forward in the state of Arizona with regard to providing, you know, being able to move clinicians along and getting them better, right? I appreciate the fact of like, hey, I can look into getting licensed and doing these things. And I do think it's important that we provide young clinicians guidelines and supervision experiences and mentorship. Like, no one disagrees with that. I think the part that I struggle with is CARD is a large organization. CARD operates in multiple states. We have many organizations like that in the state of Arizona. And I don't need to list them all, but we have many multi-state, multi-site operations. And so we do need leaders such as yourselves out there doing the things you're doing, but we need you to understand the regulatory impact of that and the impact that it could have on individuals seeking licensure. And I think what I'm hearing from you is you do recognize maybe perhaps now the gravity of that. And that gives me some comfort. I guess my question would be the the proof will be in the pudding, right? It's what kinds of things are you going to change going forward now? You know, tomorrow, how many of these other meetings are going on in Arizona, you know, scheduled for next week? And how quickly are we going to be able to pivot to something that is in line and respects the regulatory and statute, the regulatory guidelines and the statutes and rules in the state of Arizona? And then, you know, bigger picture, as someone who's, you know, who operates a multi-site, multi-state, is then what are we doing to understand regulations in other states that CARD may operate in? It's not just an Arizona issue. And so I think that that's kind of where I'm at in terms of the discussion, Dr. Stenhoff.
And I'd like to provide a response to that, if it's okay. I only have one fellow who's currently in Arizona that's actively was receiving supervision from myself, and she actually went on maternity leave just last week. So I actually don't have any current people receiving supervision for the year of 2024. I do have a concern about some fellows that received supervision from me previously who are no longer at CARD. So I'll be reaching out to them directly and letting them know that they need to have the 1500 hours of supervised fieldwork under a licensed Arizona professional, and they need to not count those hours that were under myself. And, because I am one of the senior clinicians at CARD, I'm going to take this to our bigger, I don't know if it calls a board, but our bigger group of clinicians. And we're going to have an in-depth discussion about our interactions with how we use corporate BCBAs in states with licensure. And I'm not the one who can make all those decisions or have all those discussions myself, because I'm the clinician education manager for a very specific component of CARD. But I will take all of the concerns to the bigger group. And I'm sure we can address that either through, you know, knowledge that we need to have Arizona licensure before these types of practices are being implemented, and understanding the relationship between outside BCBAs and Arizona mentees and patients. I would be very shocked if we were the only company that was doing this, right? I don't think that this is like an isolated incident. Any company that's providing services across state levels that has a corporate department that's outside of the state of Arizona, those BCBAs that work there are likely engaging and with Arizona BCBAs and Arizona mentees. So I, like I said, I'd be surprised if this was an isolated incident. So it is definitely something I want to remedy for CARD, but I would worry about like the greater implications of that and support for Arizona, really, is what I would be concerned about.
Thank you. Thank you for your response. I'll stop there, Dr. Stenhoff.
Dr. Reese, any further?
Yeah, I would agree with what my fellow committee members have already indicated. I do appreciate the added level of support that you're providing your young BCBAs. I think it's a wonderful model, and I would strongly encourage you to think about how you can become licensed in the state of Arizona so that that model does not exclude the Arizona licensees that you have here and the BCBAs that you have here, because I do think it's important to provide additional support and supervision. So I appreciate that you have that model, and I would hope that you will pursue how you can do that while meeting all of the statutes here in our state.
I have full intention of making sure that Arizona gets the same level of support as all of our other states. And just ask for forgiveness and not understanding the legislation and the code as the full extent that I should have, and that we did think that we met the exemption as outside BCBAs, but it sounds like you guys have come to the conclusion that we did not. And I guess my question would be for the action that happens after that.
Ms. Keeler, I have a question for you. How many of you are there? I'll say it that way. And what I mean by that is Ms. Nolte is no longer with CARD, and I don't know if she's providing any level of supervision as well, continued in the state of Arizona. The reason I ask that is I'm going to, you know, you're headed for an iceberg.
Yeah.
How soon can you change the course? Because as you stated earlier, it's a large company. And so that's why I'm asking, what would that look like, or how, if we haven't obviously finished our discussion yet, but how soon would that be able to be changed or corrected?
I would argue that me going to the group and saying, hey, talk to the board, they have these recommendations for us that we need to follow, that's going to be taken seriously, right? So there's about six BCBAs that I can count in my head just quickly at CARD currently, who would be potentially not licensed in Arizona, but providing training or consultation to their BCBAs without the clinical practice piece. So not what I'm doing, but other types of things like challenging behavior is happening. They ask for support from a California BCBA who has experience with that type of patient. There's about six of us who do those consultations on a regular basis. So, and that would be a question to you. Is that inappropriate for us to be providing? No, so that's not inappropriate, or okay.
We can't advise.
Yeah. Okay, so interesting. Okay, so I would say it will be taken seriously. I will work on my Arizona licensure. I already submitted some of my paperwork and some of it had gone through. I'll just have to restart the process, I assume, to make sure that people get that support. And I'll work with my colleagues to make sure we have more of us corporate clinicians licensed in Arizona as well, since that is an important component of all of this.
Okay. And I'm going to also say, and again, we haven't finished our discussion, expediency would be of great interest to the company.
Yes, that makes sense.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
And do you want me to just add? Oh, sorry.
Yeah, Ms. Moulton.
I'll just say that the company that I'm at right now had just been in California and just recently moved into Nebraska, and those are the only states we serve. So there is no issue in my current company of any issues in licensure in Arizona.
Okay, thank you. All right. Committee members, let's come to a decision and move ahead. So any further discussion and then do we need a motion for anything, or are we just at the discussion level?
Dr. Stenhoff, just one other point of clarification, like with all this discussion, I think that I would ask Ms. Keeler in particular, given Ms. Nolte's response, that, communicating back to the board staff with what you've done. I think not only your licensure, but hey, here are the steps that I'd like you to share back with the board, that I've taken in my role, at CARD, but also as my role as a BCBA, and my role soon as a licensed behavior analyst, hopefully in the state of Arizona. And, I can't force you to do that, but I would strongly recommend that you put something together back to us that board staff could share with the committee. Because I want to be very honest, like the next level, you asked about like what the next actions are. The committee could issue a cease and desist, which would then require us to essentially send your names to the national practitioner database, of which for, going forward, you would be selecting, yes, you've been reported for every single credentialing job you may, any kind of time you go forward with an agency where you might be credentialed. I mean, it could have a huge impact on your career and your ability to continue to do services. And that is not our intention, but you have to understand we too have to follow the statutes and the rules. And so I would just strongly encourage that you dive deep into this and make sure that there's nothing else that we don't have to have this conversation again, and that you give us an outline of what your plan is going forward.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I make sure to do that. So is there a specific place I should send that, the email address?
Mr. Chair, I suggest correspond with me, please, since I reached out to you, with the invitation to appear, and thank you. I'll ensure that, this information is prepared and transmitted to the committee appropriately. So work with me, please, and that way, if I have any questions or need clarification, then, we can exchange that through email. Mm-hmm.
So do would one of you care to make a motion?
If the motion would be no action at this time. I mean, do we need to have a motion to that extent? Yes.
Yes, you need to make a motion so the record is clear what action the board decided to take or not take.
Okay. So our motion is to take no action at this time. Do I have a second?
Second.
Further discussion?
And to be clear, this is for both Ms. Brittany Keeler and Ms. Nolte.
Correct. Right, no further discussion. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
I'm still thinking about my discussion yet.
You want further discussion, Dr. Davey?
Just one point of further discussion for the committee members. I apologize. And that is, understand the cease and desist we're not interested in the no action. However, the one piece that I am wondering still in the back of my mind is the, BACB guidelines are quite clear around the regulatory piece. And I just want to make sure that we feel we're comfortable that we've had the discussion with our colleague and have made inroads with her behavior in the future, and that we are clear that we don't feel as if a complaint to the board is to the national board is needed.
I, given given the circumstance of, or the nature of the supervision, and the comments made by both Ms. Keeler and Ms. Nolte, it's particularly Ms. Keeler because she's still employed with the agency that's also doing services here in the state of Arizona. It sounds like that the course of action makes a lot of sense, and we've had that discussion. It appears that that discussion has made a point to move forward with corrective action. So that.
Very good. I'm good with my discussion then.
Okay. All right. And then I'm gonna ask for a vote again. All in favor, say aye.
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 All right, motion carries.
Dr. Stenhoff, was that an aye for you?
Oh, yes, it was aye.
So just clarifying that last piece there, is the corrective action going to the national board for this? I apologize,
No,
Mike.
there is not. Ms. Galvin, correct?
There's not, this is just a recommendation to the full board. The full
Okay.
board will have to consider this probably at the meeting on January 12th. I'm not sure. So right now the motion was just to take no action. And that of course is subject to board approval and they can decide otherwise.
Okay. And then I'll provide the written documentation ideally before that meeting that happens next of the actions that will be taken.
In light of that, Mr. Chair, I'm going to, I think what we will do is we'll actually agendize this for February 9th. Seems like a quick turnaround to expect from Ms. Keeler and Ms. Nolte to correspond with me. And so, and given this isn't, what I'm hearing the committee say is the public isn't at any, risk in the meantime, we can certainly accommodate this comfortably on the February 9th agenda. And Ms. Keeler, Ms. Nolte, we'll notice you how to attend that meeting if you choose to. So the just expect some sort of correspondence from me. And I will include, I think it makes sense for our purposes to provide you with a deadline. So I'll give you a reasonable deadline with which to supply what it seems that you're agreeing to supply, and then we'll go from there.
And thank you both for attending. It was very helpful to have you here. So I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
All right. Next item is agenda item number 9, discussion, consideration, possible action regarding request for withdrawal of behavior analyst application. Ms. Malice, this is your list on this item.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Just to give you a brief summary for the first applicant, Alicia Peterson. She came before the committee in February of 2023, and she was approved for her BA license, but she has not yet paid for her application. And recent correspondence indicated that she does not want to pursue her licensure in this state. And so the memo is about her possibly withdrawing her application if the committee recommends that.
Ms. Mills, you were, it just might have been for me, but you were cutting out. Could you repeat the first part of that? I heard the last part about the recommendation to withdraw it.
Yes, I apologize, Dr. Davey.
That might have been my end.
With her application, she did not pay for her application. She did go through the process for licensure, and she was approved by the board. And this was before we were using the computer system. And so it was a paper application, and those would come in with the check, but she did not pay for her application. And so she's on the agenda for a possible withdrawal of her application based on the correspondence I had with her on December 7th.
Okay. So board staff, I guess, question, with regard to the process there, was we just like, did we just miss the payment, or like, how did we get it through?
Mr. Chair, Dr. Davey, I'd like to respond to that. So what we, I think we're experiencing here is these are in many cases, these are applications that are coming in, you know, as part of a big tsunami, a big wave of many applications. And so while we're tracking, you know, payment, obviously, that was a paper-based process. And so, you know, it's laborious. It requires, you know, checking through different files and so forth. And so because we are in extreme processing mode, I'll call it, and in our eagerness to get the application file to the committee, we may or may not have the payment. It's rare. It's quite rare that you would see an application where we hadn't received the payment. But, you know, our audit processes, our verification processes ensure that, you know, no one gets issued a license if the payment has never been issued. So we are in our haste to get you the applications. All along, we are assuming that the applicant is going to submit the payment, but we will never issue the license until the payment is received. So if they don't bother to tell us they're not going to pay for it, if they don't bother to tell us, or it doesn't occur to them to tell us, hey, I've changed my mind, I actually don't want or need this license, then we're none the wiser. And yeah. So, you know, when our post review audit, you know, identifies that there's this fee payment deficiency, you know, then it has to be addressed. As Ms. Malice points out, what is preferable about our process now is that you can't even submit without paying the fee. And so the application doesn't even exist to us. Which is vastly better than, you know, us sort of finding out, oh, we approved your license months ago, but your application is deficient. And so, you know, it's a frustrating dynamic, but it's also one that is a challenge, has been a challenge for us to manage. This should be the last instances where you see these kinds of situations present.
honestly, I was of the mindset that, you know, these applicants should be denied for failure to pay unless they request to withdraw. Ms. Galvin's advice to us was a little different, that, you know, we just close the application. We recommend to the board that the applications be closed. And then going forward, this isn't a systemic problem or a recurring problem on any level.
Okay. Very good. Then I'll make a motion that we allow the withdrawal.
And Dr. Davey, is that for both Ms. Peterson and Garza?
Yes, that's the circumstances.
Okay. All right. Do we have a second?
I will second.
Okay. Any further discussion? All in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Okay. Motion carries. Agenda item 10. Consideration of possible action to include denial of application for failure to pay the required application fee. Ms. Malice, again, this is you.
Yes, Mr. Chair. This applicant, Shenandoah Tallman, is similar to the previous applicant, although she did not communicate back to me from the email that I sent to her with regards to payment. So I don't have any information in terms of her intention on the application. I can only say that she has not paid for her application. And so she is at the committee for possible withdrawal of her application as well.
All right. Given the facts of the previous case and the discussion previously, I'll go ahead and make the motion to have the withdrawal of this application as well for failure to, one, respond to our emails, but also for the application fee.
Okay, a second?
I'll second.
Discussion? All in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Okay, motion carries. All right, next item, discussion, consideration, possible action regarding election of 2024 committee chair, Ms. Packham.
Yes, Mr. Chair. So the committee's statute requires that you annually elect from your members a chair. So we were unable to get to that agenda item in December. We tried to have that as a December item so that the chair is identified and can be prepared for the first meeting of the year. In this instance, we were unable to do that. Our 2023 chair was unavailable to attend today. So the statutes don't preclude us from having an interim or acting chair. So Dr. Stenhoff, fortunately, is always willing to step in and conduct that role. But we do need to elect a chair at some point. Whether, as I read the statute, you have the latitude as to when this annual election occurs. That being said, you know, there are only 3 of 5 members here, and so that may have some bearing on your decision as to whether you decide to take this action today or move it to the February agenda.
I'd recommend let's move to February. It'd be best to have the whole committee here.
We recommend that with you staying as the interim. Do we have to say that?
Dr. Davey, I was going to propose if we need an interim, Dr. Davey or Dr. Reitz, but certainly.
No, not it.
No, I'm happy to, yes.
Yeah, we're Dr. Reitz. It's actually Dr. Reitz's turn to serve as the boss. I mean, I think this should be in the ring.
I would agree. Let's hold till February.
Everybody's messaging Heidi right now how they're not available.
All right. Do we do we need to vote on this or do we just move on?
Just table it. Yeah, you're okay.
Okay. All right. So we'll table that. All right. So next, where are we? Okay. Discussion, consideration, possible action regarding application error presenting master's degree advisors in the doctoral degree program section. Ms. Packham.
Yes, Mr. Chair. So I'd hope to have an update for you, a positive development type of update for you. And hopefully my explanation that I supplied made sense. We did some investigation and testing, and it seems that what you were seeing sort of seemed like suddenly this proliferation, this new issue of data appearing in a field that was incorrect relative to the education section. It's a system error. So there was some sort of modification made, maybe to the psychology applications that had some implications for the BA application. We don't really know. We have an active and open ticket to get this issue fixed, but Ms. Malice was able to identify how it was that applicants were putting the correct information in the correct place, but the system was pulling it and then populating the wrong field so that when we see it, it looks, it's incorrect. It appears to be problematic. So kind of a very odd situation. But what I have confidence in is that it will get fixed. At least we have the vendor of the system is committed to fixing everything that, you know, we identify as a problem. I just don't have an update to this service ticket yet. It was submitted really almost immediately after the last meeting when Z found it. Yeah, it was December 5th. So within days of the last meeting, we knew what the problem was, and hopefully it will not be an ongoing problem a whole lot longer. Do you have any questions about that? Okay, so it's not an education issue, it's a technology issue, and you know, we'll just have to live with it on a temporary basis.
All right, thank you. And then Ms. Pakenham, would you also go ahead and discuss 13 regarding the BACB update?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I haven't been issued anything by way of a, you know, broad communication to regulators from the BACB. I know they are planning the regulator training program scheduled for March 7th in earnest. So they have Misty Bloom in particular, specifically. They have invited Dr. Davey, Dr. Davis Wilson, and myself to meet with them. They are going to be in Tucson next week for meetings and a workshop. So we will meet with them next week on Thursday the 11th and provide some input into the program that they are planning for that particular meeting. So we're grateful, I think, to have that opportunity to help shape what the discussion involves. Any questions to that or comments?
Well, enjoy your time down there.
Thank you. So I think, Mr. Chair, I don't remember that we, did we do the vote on the minutes, or were we may have gone just right past the minutes because we were eager to get to Ms. Patron on agenda item 5 because we knew her time with us was very limited. So did the committee members, did I miss it, or did the committee members remember a vote there?
I think we did a bulk vote, or we bulked on, if I remember right.
Okay.
You know, the reality is, you know, I don't know. I was thinking about this and I wrote it down on my agenda. I don't think we have quorum to be able to do it because I missed part of that meeting. I had to sign off before it was done. So I believe we should probably back those out and bring those to the next committee meeting.
So out of an abundance of caution, I think that's a good idea. So we will just roll everything over to the next agenda.
Okay. So that's a nice segue for agenda item 14, new agenda items. So we have that. There was one we just mentioned a moment ago as well. I'm not remembering. There was
13.
Oh, it was the vote, the election.
Yeah.
Okay. Any other items? Okay. All right. Moving on to the next one. Do I have a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Second?
Second.
All right. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Okay. Motion carries. Thank you, everybody.